that ribbon of highway I saw above me, that endless skyway I saw below me, those golden valleys. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As the sun was shining and I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds rolling, as the fog was lifting, a voice was saying, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York.
From overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate, and to discriminate only generates hate, and when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah, madness, but you demonstrate, and that's exactly how...
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. Two newly elected Republican governors have wiped out collective bargaining for state employees in Missouri and in Indiana. Ken Jacob with Missouri's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees says Governor Matt Blunt's assault on collective bargaining rights should be resisted.
The right to organize and collectively bargain is a fundamental right, and it needs to be fought for like all rights.
Jacob expects Missouri to honor its contract with state workers through 2006. In Indiana, AFSCME's David Warwick says GOP Governor Mitch Daniels' order attacking collective bargaining wipes out years of labor progress under Democratic governors.
He rescinded not only our rights to bargain and our union representation rights, but also he rescinded our union contract.
State employees don't have the same national labor law protections as other workers. The defeats of Democrats and victories by Republican governors in Missouri and in Indiana have dealt state workers there devastating blows. But AFSCME says that the unions will stay in place and will do whatever they can to continue to represent state employees.
It's been a rough start to the year for Starbucks. In Florida this week, a federal court judge granted collective action status to a lawsuit filed by two managers who say they are entitled to overtime pay because they are actually glorified baristas. The status gives the attorneys filing the suit permission to find other managers throughout the country who have similar complaints. Meanwhile, in New York City, workers represented by the Industrial Workers of the World watched as the National Labor Relations Board agreed with their charges that the coffee chain has been interfering with and coercing employees who have attempted to unionize.
The Labor Board also alleges in their complaint that Starbucks made outright bribes, created an impression of surveillance, and much, much more.
Daniel Gross is an employee at the New York store. According to the board, seven Starbucks officials, including Senior Vice President Martin Anisi, engaged in union intimidation. Gross says now that the board has ruled, other Starbucks employees are being encouraged to join.
No majority of workers is required. Anyone can join at any time and get started with other Starbucks folks around the country imposing real economic, political, and social costs on this company until they do the right thing. And every single Starbucks worker rises out of poverty.
Here's today's Dow Bob report. The average annual income of the richest 1% of the U.S. is well above $515,000, an increase of 89% since 1986, according to Acorn's National Living Wage Resource Center. But at the same time, a recent study of U.S. workers working more than 35 hours a week found that poverty among them has risen. Since 1994, more than 50 cities and counties in the U.S. have passed living wage ordinances in an effort to make sure full-time workers rise above poverty.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with the Cuban blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org or call 215-563-7110.
Maybe you're one of the 2 million Americans who've recently had their jobs offshore to India, Pakistan, and elsewhere. Or one of the millions more expected to have your job shipped abroad in the next few years. If so, don't worry, bucko, for a new growth industry has arisen that offers exciting job opportunities for you discarded Americans. You, too, could become an American accent and culture trainer. It seems that while such corporations as Citibank, Dell, GE, and Microsoft are eager to abandon the U.S. and move their telephone service jobs to low-wage workers abroad, these English-speaking foreign workers are, well, foreign. So their accents and cultural references can be jarring to U.S. customers placing orders or seeking help. Thus, offshoring companies are hiring Americans to teach foreign replacement workers to sound and behave like Americans. Yes, this means you could end up teaching the Indian or Pakistani or Russian who was given your job how to sound like you. Courses in American Culture 101 include U.S. history memorization, American slang, basic sports knowledge, and pop culture. Quick, what's the Lone Star State? Who are the Florida Marlins? Can you name one talent that Britney Spears has? What's a burrito? The lesson plans for these courses include having to watch episodes of Friends and screening such films as Bruce Almighty. As for accents, there are voice exercises for Indians, for example, to help them lower their natural high-pitched and clipped pronunciation of English. And if the exercises are not enough, the corporate call centers use technology to filter the telephone voices of the foreign service reps, making them sound lower than they are. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, it won't be long before the corporations train low-paid foreigners to teach American accents and culture to foreign workers. Then there'll be no need for American workers at all.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac. The libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what. Support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library. So make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Exposes political corruption and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org. In cable systems in 29 states on cable radio network. And she's up. Oh, yeah. And with archives at WhiteRoseSociety.org and on TomHartman.com, you can drop into our live chat room and also find archives of the program. Welcome to our show today. Is the lesson of Rathergate, Dan Rather's foibles, 60 Minutes here, that journalists can be punished if they've offended the wrong people? If somebody merely helps steer the country into a war in which Americans die under false pretenses, then they get medals. But if you publicize a forged document, you lose your job? Could that be the case? George Sakala is the communications director of RightMarch.com, the conservative alternative to MoveOn.org. And, George, I guess you have a little different take on it than what I just laid out.
Well, how you doing, Tom? Nice to be here.
I'm great. And, George, we use your stuff all the time, by the way. We have conservative alerts on this show regularly. Good work
Thanks.
You guys do.
Thanks. Well, RightMarch.com is, you know, it's the umbrella website for conservative organizations and
yeah.
Americans
I should
across
I should
the
add,
country.
By the way, prior to joining RightMarch.com, George was an account executive with the Washington Times. Are you a Mooney?
No. I'm just regular Roman Catholic. But I was my first job out of college.
And it didn't bother you working for the guy who says that Jesus Christ was a screw up and he's replaced him.
Yeah.
Well, no, I'm serious. That's what Reverend Moon said last year.
Yeah, I know.
Didn't bother you working.
That doesn't get into the editorial pages of the paper though. Keep the business section pretty much separate from the.
I see. Okay, yeah. Well, let's get back to this issue here, because although there is some correlation there, I mean, there's people all over CBS feeling tainted by this, just like I think a lot of people at the Washington Times feel tainted by the fact that this publication is run by a cult leader who is let's say, anti-Christian, to say the very least, and yet is one of the largest funders of Jerry Falwell and one of the largest lifetime funders of George Herbert Walker Bush in terms of payment for speeches and things. But nonetheless.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that the Washington Times had done back in the early 80s was, you know, make it clear that amidst those kinds of accusations, they said, well, from now on, you know, the only church members will work on the business side, and we'll leave the reporting and the editorial up to the editors itself. So they had created this kind of separation between church and state over there during the 80s, and they had come out and cleaned house over there.
Yeah.
And, you know, but anyway, going back to the CBS story, this is big news. Dan Rather is stepping down, and we had run, you know, the full page newspaper ads about this, calling for him to step down back in September. So.
Right. Now let me get this straight. What you guys, first of all, there are a couple of pieces to this story. The first piece was that a friend of the family of George W. Bush, one of his father's three or four best friends in the world, called the head of the Texas Air National Guard and caused George W. to jump ahead of 350 other people so that he could get into the Texas Air National Guard without being hit by the draft. That was the first part of the story that Dan Rather reported, and it has been corroborated. This guy has come out and said it. You have a problem with that?
Do I have a problem with that?
I mean, do you dispute that?
Do I dispute it? I guess I wouldn't dispute it so much as...
Well, I mean, the guy said he did it, right? In fact, on the show, I'm assuming you saw the show with Dan Rather. The guy came on and he said he was ashamed of it.
Yeah. Well,
okay.
So that's a fact.
So that's a fact. So George W. pulled strings to get into the Texas Air National Guard.
George H.W. Bush pulled the strings for his son.
That's right. Pulled strings.
Not George W.
Sure. Fine. Okay. I'll give you that. Daddy pulled strings for his son to get him into the National Guard so that he could avoid going to Vietnam and being drafted. And it was definitely to avoid going to Vietnam, because at that time, the Texas Air National Guard did not go to Vietnam. In fact, it wasn't until more than a decade later that our National Guard started, you know, other than a few rare exceptions, started doing international stuff. Because basically, it's a civilian defense force. It's to, you know, in times of emergencies, if we get invaded or if we have natural disasters.
Sure. My own father was in the National
Guard.
Okay.
So you know what I'm talking about. Secondly, there was the allegation that George W. Bush didn't show up for service for a full year. There's still a guy out there offering a $100,000 reward for anybody who can come forward and say that they actually saw him down there in Florida at any of the meetings. He did show up for one dental appointment. That's all we have evidence of. Nobody's disputing that, right?
Well, I thought there had been a number of people that had served with him that had come out and said, yeah, sure, we saw him all the time.
Well, actually, there was one guy, and he got trotted out on Fox News for about 3 days in a row, and then it turned out that this guy was an alcoholic. He'd been convicted of, I'm not sure if he'd been convicted, he'd been charged with some weird crimes. He was a nutcase, and when they tried to verify his story, he had no proof of it. It fell apart, and nobody talks about him anymore. So, no, the $100,000 reward is still out there. Nobody has claimed it. So I think we can all say that part of Dan Rather's story, that George W. basically went AWOL, and see, if you're gone for more than 30 days, it's absent without leave. If you're gone for more than 31 days, it's AWOL. And if you're AWOL during time of war, which we were, not only is it a felony, it is a felony that raises itself to the level of treason. You can be put to death for it. George W. was never held to account for that. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know those facts.
Well, they're facts. I mean, you know, trust me. And these were the things that were laid out in the Rather report.
Okay.
And nobody's disputing them. And then third, George W., toward the end of his career in the Texas Air National Guard, 5 months early, says, you know, I really don't want to be in the Guard anymore. I think I'd rather go to the Harvard Business School. And he writes him a letter saying he's got other things to do, and they let him out, and he goes to Harvard Business School, which I'm sure a lot of Guard members in Iraq right now would love to be able to do. And nobody's disputing that. Right. I mean, that record's on, that letter's on the record.
Well, after he had done 5 years of service in the National Guard, sure, they let him out early, a couple months early.
Right. Exactly. And as I said, there are 50-year-olds right now in the National Guard who've been there for a whole lot more than 5 years who would love to get out, who are in Iraq, who can't. But, you know, nonetheless, that was then and this is now. Now, those were the main points of the story. To back up one of the points of the story, that being that George had used influence to get into the Guard and that he was... And the other one was that he didn't show up for the flight physical when they started doing random drug tests on the urine of the people when they did the flight physicals. You had these memos from Killian saying, you know, this guy George, he's making my life difficult or whatever. How did those memos change any of the actual facts of the case? My understanding is that all of the facts that were presented in the CBS case still stand. So what are you guys yelling about?
Well, the fact that they're basing a lot of this information off of documents that were fraudulent.
No, they're not basing any of it on those documents. They're using the documents to corroborate it, but they're not.
Sure,
basing...
but those aren't true documents.
Well,
they're corroborating it off something that's false.
Okay, now the commission that just studied this, and you know, which some folks are saying is
and where did they get those documents?
Is, well, that's a damn good question, and I'd sure like to know.
Apparently the guy who they got it from, this Burkett person, had a vendetta against then Governor George W. Bush, and B, had been in and out of psychiatric treatment.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got Dick Thornburg. He was one of the two guys who investigated this. He was he was on the payroll of Bush 41, Bush's father. And his grand accomplishment as the Bush's attorney general is to whitewash the investigation of the Exxon Valdez oil spill and let them off the hook. And, he's fat pay at counsel as counsel to Kirkpatrick and Lockhart, the Washington lobbying firm, and which works for Bush. And, he's the guy who is investigating. And then there's Bicardi. He's the CEO of Associated Press, spiked his own wire services exposure of Ali North and Ayatollah Khomeini to stop the story, right, back in 86. So you got these two guys who have long ties to Bush Sr., who investigated Dan Rather and CBS, Dick Thornburg and Bicardi. And what they concluded was that we don't know yet if these documents are forged. So the statement that you just made, that they based all this on forged documents, according to the definitive investigation done by former cronies of Bush's father, is wrong.
Well, I mean, I just flat out disagree with that. But, why was Mary Mapes coordinating with the Kerry campaign on numerous occasions? Why did they offer this guy Burkett a book deal? Why did they say, yeah, and we'll pay you too? And yeah, and we'll put you in touch with high-ranking people in the Kerry campaign.
Yeah, I mean, those are all.
Why do they do all that too? I mean,
those are all fine questions, but the reality is that the guys who looked into this for 60 minutes said
that Mary Mapes was coordinating with the Kerry campaign, tipping them off, to give them an edge in the election to combat whatever was going on with the Swift vote deal.
Well, that contradicts what the investigation found. They found that there was no political agenda at all, that these guys rushed this thing in because they wanted to scoop
the competition. No, they said that gave the appearance of political bias.
Yeah. Okay.
But, I mean, what does that mean? I mean, the CBS computers can go off and tip off the Kerry campaign.
Let's say for a moment, George Sakala of rightmarch.org, let's say for a moment that you're just absolutely right. And that CBS had these folks at CBS who are no longer there had a political vendetta, and they were gonna try and embarrass George W. Bush by sharing this part of his past, and even that they were gonna try and coordinate it with the Kerry campaign. Let's say that that's the case. Isn't that relatively routinely done over at Fox News?
Over at Fox, I don't know. I've never worked for Fox News.
You don't know about the Daily Memo from Roger Ailes?
No.
Oh, okay.
Tell me about it.
Well, okay. I would suggest you do a little research. First of all, number one, I'd say this is a tempest in a teapot. Secondly, Here we have a news organization which had a false document or a couple of false documents, and they built a story on it, and they brought the story out to the American people. And, you know, whether or not it was a big deal is arguable since George W. won the election. And on the other hand, we have an administration which took some documents which were forged and shared them with the world and used them as a justification for what has now led to the death of over 100,000 human beings, including over 1,300 of our soldiers, the loss of arms, legs, eyes, ears, the over 1,300 of our soldiers, or over 10,000 of our soldiers, the emotional and psychological devastation of tens of thousands of our soldiers, and you don't think that that's a problem?
Well, what I think is a problem with, if you want to talk about the Iraq War, what I think is the real problem is that, you know, in 1991, after we had settled the Iraq problem, supposedly, and put the sanctions on Iraq and maintained the no-fly zone, which was maintained by mainly the United States and Great Britain, you know, the UN then actively undermined our efforts to maintain the no-fly zone with their oil for food scandal. Because the no-fly zone and the sanctions were meant to squeeze Saddam Hussein out of power economically.
Hey, the no-fly zone was being held. A good friend of mine took 36 bullets in northern Iraq during the no-fly zone time because Saddam was going up there with tanks instead of aircraft. It was solid. Well, let's take some calls. George Sakala right after this break. We're talking with George Sakala, rightmarch.org. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews. What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer. The new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
This job is so much more than a half-hour newscast.
Brian Williams on the NBC Nightly News.
These are very serious times. This is about our world, our children. This is about as high as the stakes
get. Ongoing engagements, firefighting.
Is my world safe? Is my nation safe? Is my family safe? That's our job. That's our duty. That's all that counts.
Reporting America's story. NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams.
My job is to tell the story of our lives.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. George W. Bush, pretty explicit about all this.
We see clear evidence of peril. We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Hans Blix had a somewhat different idea. He was rather outspoken about that.
You know, in the Middle Ages, when people were convinced there were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
And that's why the rest of the world didn't think there were weapons of mass destruction, because Hans Blix was saying, no, there aren't. It's funny how the cons continue to say this. Anyhow, we're talking with George Sakala, communications director, rightmarch.com, www.rightmarch.com, conservative alternative to moveon.org. And, George, you mind if we take a few phone calls here?
Go ahead.
Okay, 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Ross in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Ross.
How you doing today?
Great. What's up?
Well, I keep seeing that the left, as well as the right did when Clinton got into office, keeps harping on 30-year-old activities by these two men. And I really think it's time to get over what they did. I mean, Bill Clinton was in Russia doing rallies against the United States.
He was not in Russia. He was in England. He was attending Oxford University. He was going on a Fulbright scholarship.
But was he... what was he up to? And
he attended an anti-war rally.
Okay, well,
and George W. Bush,
it was 30 years ago.
I agree with you, Ross. I agree with you. We're not talking about what happened 30 years ago. We're talking about the fact that CBS just fired 5 people this week.
And they didn't even fire the guy who deserved it. And I'm talking about Dan Rather. And
okay, here's my question for you, Ross. The New York Times repeatedly published papers, largely these articles by Judith Miller, that were based on forged documents and lies that led us into this war in Iraq. In other words, Judith Miller was repeating the lies that were coming out of the Bush administration. Why wasn't she fired? Why hasn't rightmarch.org, which is, concerned about lies in the media, why haven't you gone after the New York Times for publishing lies about, the fact that there were weapons, their assertion that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
Well, because we know Saddam Hussein had them, we know he used them, and we know he threatened to use them again.
Well, and we know that they were destroyed.
And then when you have
the report of Scott Ritter,
his own people, making threats to, hey, I might just set off a nuclear device in Israel, which would be disastrous for that region, you got to kind of take that seriously.
But after Scott Ritter had been in the country for 5 years, had destroyed everything he could find, after Hans Blix had been through the country for several months and said,
well,
we're pretty sure.
Well, I'm not going to take the advice of Scott Ritter, but go ahead.
And what about Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei?
Those are socialist Europeans. They have their own interest in Iraq. Obviously. That's where they get their oil from.
Okay,
that's why they opposed us.
We have found that there was nothing there. So you guys were wrong.
Well, they might have been transferred out of the country. We might not have found them yet.
Maybe aliens. Maybe Reverend Moon magically transmuted them.
Maybe.
Yeah, okay. 1-866-889-8894. Alice in Arkansas is on the line. Hey, Alice.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tom. You just made me laugh.
Well, that's what's up.
I just want to point out the hypocrisy of all this when you have, from yesterday's Boston Globe, a quote from Max Boot about the Niger forgeries, you know, saying the Senate investigation found that there were some genuine intelligence of Sodom-seeking uranium, so it was okay that those were forged, almost, is what he's saying.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay for them to, that side, to justify what they've done when there was no evidence.
Yeah.
But on Dan Rather's part, and if you look at, you know...
No, I've got your point, Allison.
But if you also,
we're out of time here, and I want to give George the last word, because we're just wrapping up. George, you got 5-10 seconds here. I'll give you the last word on this.
Well, I just wanted to say thanks for having me on, and I hope that concerned Americans that agree with us will visit our website at www.rightmarch.com.
Rightmarch.org, right?
.com.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, rightmarch.com. Thank you very much. Thanks for correcting me. George Sakala, thanks for being with us today. 29 minutes past the hour.
Mom, I can't believe you asked Rick all those questions. Where do you live, and who are your parents? It's so embarrassing.
Getting to know your kid's friends isn't easy. But if you don't, he's more likely to do drugs.
Geez, do you have to know everything?
Actually, Sean, I do. Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for a Drug-Free America.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. Two newly elected Republican governors have wiped out collective bargaining for state employees in Missouri and in Indiana. Ken Jacob with Missouri's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees says Governor Matt Blunt's assault on collective bargaining rights should be resisted.
The right to organize and collectively bargain is a fundamental right, and it needs to be fought for like all rights.
Jacob expects Missouri to honor its contract with state workers through 2006. In Indiana, AFSCME's David Warwick says GOP Governor Mitch Daniels' order attacking collective bargaining wipes out years of labor progress under Democratic governors.
He rescinded not only our rights to bargain and our union representation rights, but also he rescinded our union contract.
State employees don't have the same national labor law protections as other workers. The defeats of Democrats and victories by Republican governors in Missouri and in Indiana have dealt state workers their devastating blows. But AFSCME says that the unions will stay in place and will do whatever they can to continue to represent state employees.
It's been a rough start to the year for Starbucks. In Florida this week, a federal court judge granted collective action status to a lawsuit filed by two managers who say they are entitled to overtime pay because they are actually glorified baristas. The status gives the attorneys filing the suit permission to find other managers throughout the country who have similar complaints. Meanwhile, in New York City, workers represented by the Industrial Workers of the World watched as the National Labor Relations Board agreed with their charges that the coffee chain has been interfering with and coercing employees who have attempted to unionize.
The Labor Board also alleges in their complaint that Starbucks made outright bribes, created an impression of surveillance, and much, much more.
Daniel Gross is an employee at the New York store. According to the board, seven Starbucks officials, including Senior Vice President Martin Anisi, engaged in union intimidation. Gross says now that the board has ruled, other Starbucks employees are being encouraged to join.
No majority of workers is required. Anyone can join at any time and get started with other Starbucks folks around the country imposing real economic, political, and social costs on this company until they do the right thing. And every single Starbucks worker rises out of poverty.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The average annual income of the richest 1% of the U.S. is well above $515,000, an increase of 89% since 1986, according to Acorn's National Living Wage Resource Center. But at the same time, a recent study of U.S. workers working more than 35 hours a week found that poverty among them has risen. Since 1994, more than 50 cities and counties in the U.S. have passed living wage ordinances in an effort to make sure full-time workers rise above poverty.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear.
Oh, what a great old group. Remember Lou Reed? I'm dating myself. Yeah, well, actually, he's got a new album. Anyhow, 27 minutes before the hour, the Velvet Underground was the, back in those days. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And really, I think it's time for us to have our... You know, George Bush moment.
Just a little girl.
This is Laura.
I knew I'd marry a president.
Laura Bush.
I had a song then going through my head, but no idea what it meant. Get Saddam, Saddam. I felt that would be the key to national unity.
And it was the key to the 2004 campaign, actually. You know.
We beat him not just once, but twice. Both times he slipped through our little hands.
Aww.
But my husband takes after my father-in-law. He's such a patient man.
Get Saddam, Saddam. We'll find him somewhere, someday. Maybe he'll just go away. Get Saddam, Saddam.
Actually, we have him now.
Sometimes when he's got football on, I say, now, honey, where can he be? He says...
He'll turn up. Just leave me alone, honey, when I'm watching the TV.
Get Saddam, Saddam.
That's from Jim Tur, Blue Canyon Productions, BlueCanyonSatire.com.
The SOB he was doomed.
Yes.
Get Saddam.
Get Saddam. The Laura Bush song, the marvelous. And it was a great campaign strategy, as Karl Rove laid out in early 2002. No president, no U.S. president during time of war has ever failed to get reelected. And now it is kill the messenger time. Let's go after CBS. For using forged documents to back up an otherwise truthful story. But let's not go after the New York Times for using forged documents to back up a false story. What? He's picking on the New York Times. I thought he was a liberal. No, the truth is the truth, my friends. Why isn't anybody going after Judith Miller for using lies from the Bush administration to hype the war on terror, or for that matter, against CBS, ABC, NBC, CNN, and Fox, which does this stuff virtually daily, or the Bush administration, for that matter. I mean, here's the bottom line. It's the lesson of Rathergate. The journalists can be punished if they've offended the wrong people. Oh, he offended George W. Bush. We can't afford to have him punish us. He will cut off our access. If they merely help steer the country into a war under false pretenses, then they get medals of honor, freedom, and all this other kind of nonsense. Mary in Virginia is on the line, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Hey, and by the way, to Alice, I'm sorry I cut you off. Alice was our last caller. Hard breaks on this program. We just came right up against the edge of it. I had to say thanks to George and get him off. But if you had another point, Alice, you want to make, feel free to call back. Mary in Virginia, welcome to the program. I'm fine, but I can't hear you, Mary. You got to pick up the phone and talk into it.
Okay. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. What's up?
First off, I really like to say that I like listening to your show and being informed on what's really going on in our government. Just wish you were on more than just 1 hour in the afternoon.
Well, I'm serious. Yeah, we're on 3 hours on a lot of radio stations.
Oh, are you?
And on our web stream and so on. But anyway, it's
okay. You know, well, my question
frankly,
is,
I have to say, you know, we're grateful for that 1 hour. So I'm not going to knock.
Well, I get on your website and I'm informed that way as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, my question is, since it's been finally made known that there are, without a doubt, that there are no weapons of mass destruction, can you tell me that why can't we impeach George W. Bush?
Well, we can. And in fact, articles of impeachment have been brought forward.
Wonderful.
The former Attorney General of the United States, whose name is escaping me at the moment, but under Jimmy Carter, Jimmy Carter's Attorney General, Ramsey Clark, drafted articles of impeachment against George W. Bush. And they have been floating around for some time, and I believe a member of Congress actually introduced them. The reason why he won't be impeached is because for anything like that to happen requires the majority leader of the House or Senate to introduce it for a vote, for a floor vote. And Tom DeLay and Denny Hastert on the one hand in the House and Bill Frist in the Senate are simply not going to let that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Period. I mean, that's the bottom. That's why there are no investigations of all the crimes that have been committed. Everybody's screaming about oil for food. Well, what about Halliburton's involvement in oil for food? Well, nobody's talking about that. In fact, they blacked out that part of the documents.
I think it's time that the American people start demanding and start saying this enough's enough.
Yeah.
I get very upset to find out that so many of our men and women have died and wounded, and what's it going to affect their lives and their families' lives for the rest of the time that they are on Earth, the ones that are wounded. But, I mean, the final report did not make my paper's headlines. You know where it made it?
No.
On page 6, in the very bottom, one paragraph.
Yeah, yeah. See, this is the Reichification of America.
Mm-hmm.
These cons of folks from rightmarch.com and the so-called accuracy and media guys, they have very successfully, with a lot of money and a lot of effort, terrorized the mass media in America.
Yeah.
I mean, they've absolutely terrorized them, and the Bush administration has continued this process. And it is not healthy for America. It is not healthy for democracy. And not to mention the fact that it's wrong. But, I mean, it's just not healthy. And what we are seeing is this incredible screaming turn to the right in the United States. And it's been happening so rapidly over the last couple of years that it is starting to give me the creepy reminiscent feelings of when I lived in Germany and people told me stories about what it was like in the 30s there.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I think that George W. is going to create a Holocaust here, but he's already set up now 6 concentration camps for people of Middle Eastern ancestry, by and large.
Well, he's making his base. He's putting his agenda into effect, and the American people, there are a lot like you, like me, that are seeing this, but I don't know if it's enough. I mean, it's time for those people to start standing up. But I think a lot of American people are brainwashed, and you saw that in November 4th.
Yeah.
We had a chance to change things around, and not that I'm saying Kerry was the number one, that he could have changed it all, but at least we would have gotten a change and moved forward in something better.
Yeah,
I just thank you so much for being on the radio and listening to you, and you just keep up the great work.
I'll do my very best, Mary. Thanks a lot for the call, and thank you for your kind words. I do appreciate it. CBS staffers here. This is from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. It's a really solid group. It was co-founded by Jeff Cohen, one of my heroes. And just a remarkable, shortly after the report about Bush's National Guard service aired on 60 Minutes, right-wing commentators and bloggers claimed that the documents supporting the report were fraudulent. Now, I found this particularly interesting, by the way, just as a starting point. How was it that within 3 hours of the CBS report being aired, a right-wing blogger who had no background in typography was suddenly an expert in typography and was exposing the documents? Now, see, I'm of the opinion that CBS got, and this is the investigation that I'd like to see, I'm of the opinion that CBS was fed these things by the Cheney folks. I mean, this is a classic Rove, or by the Rove folks, this is a classic Rove tactic. When Rove was managing the campaign of a candidate for the governor of Texas before he worked for George W. Bush, and this guy was sliding way, way back behind in the polls, Rove bugged his own office, called in the press, accused his opponent of it, made a huge stink about it. And that, number one, knocked off the front pages the unfavorable publicity that was coming out about his client at the time, and which never again got back on its feet. And number two, made the opponent look like somebody who would bug somebody, and Rove won the election. And this is a classic Karl Rove, in my opinion. This is why, where the real investigation, in my opinion, you're going to do an investigation. Where did those documents come from? Who created these things? This guy who was supposedly the source. We still don't know the source. Here you've got these journalists at CBS who are taking the same position that the folks in the Valerie Plame investigation are, that they're not revealing their sources, right? More or less. Well, where did they come from? Where did these things come from? This is an investigation. If CBS is going to do investigative reporting, and they're going to investigate themselves, that's the story that I'd like to see. In fact, Christina Borgeson, one of the editors of Into the Buzzsaw, which is an absolutely brilliant book, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of the Free Press. My favorite chapter in Into the Buzzsaw is the one about the folks in Florida who exposed the bovine growth hormone and were fired by Fox Television, the Fox Television station, which then went all the way to the federal court, all the way to federal appeals court, to rule that they could force reporters to lie on the air. And they won. Fox won. They called that a victory, that they could force reporters to lie on the air. But that's a whole other thing. It was one of my favorite chapters of the book Into the Buzzsaw. Christina Borgeson, the editor of that, she says, having spent 3 years at CBS producing hours for CBS Reports with Dan Rather, having won an Emmy for investigative reporting the process, and having had to verify documents for my own shows, I can tell you that the bottom line onus is on the producer. And then she goes through all this stuff, but blah-de-blah-de-blah. But the real question she points out, she says, to quote her, the core question surrounding the CBS debacle was not examined at all by the August Thornburg-Bocardi investigation. Where did those documents come from and who created them? I'd sure like to know. Aren't you curious? Perhaps Kate in Arcata, California is curious. Our number, by the way, 1-866-889-8894. Hey, Kate, how are you today? What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I'm great. Well, yes, I would like that to be investigated further. I wanted to also get back to the guest that you had before, just for a moment, and then go back to what you were talking about.
Sure.
The hypocrisy and the willingness to believe lies just amazes me, but especially the argument that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and used them on his own people. They ignore the fact that they got the weapons from us. And they also ignore the fact that since we went into this illegal war against Iraq, 1,300 of our own people have been killed, and over 100,000 people, of the same people that they're being so bleeding heart about Saddam Hussein killing.
Right, according to the British journal The Lancet, which did what they consider to be the only good scientific study, but it didn't actually count bodies. The group that's actually counting bodies is saying that, somewhere around 15,000 innocent civilian non-combatants have been killed in Iraq.
Either way.
So, yeah, exactly.
I'd rather use the accurate figure, the one that's counting the bodies, although it's probably more than that. But,
it's definitely far more than that, because many people who are killed by our soldiers are not brought into hospitals. Their families simply take them out and bury them.
And likewise with the amount of people who have been killed of American soldiers haven't been, sometimes if they don't die on the field, they aren't counted. Or I heard that somewhere myself. But
yeah, we don't count them as casualties if they die in Germany as a result of wounds. Yeah.
And then not to mention the thousands of Americans who have been wounded and maimed, et cetera.
Yeah.
So, it's so hypocritical to say, Saddam used these weapons, yet we're using worse weapons.
Right, and his use of gas up in the north was during the war with Iran, and which we were feeding both sides.
Exactly.
And providing intelligence to Iran and providing weapons to Saddam, and the Kurds were in the middle. And none of which is to excuse Saddam. The point is,
exactly.
There's the world is full of tin horn dictators and terrible people, and many of whom we sell weapons of mass destruction to. But this guy presented no threat to us. The entire world knew it, which is why they wouldn't join us in going to war, other than Tony Blair, Tony Blair, let's say. And it's just mind-boggling. Anyhow, I got to move along. Kate, thanks for your comments. I appreciate it. This is Dave in Columbus is on the line. Dave is in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing today?
Good. What's up?
Oh, well, I wanted to answer this question for you on where the documents came from. But I did want to first say I was kind of disappointed in your guest. Seems like you went out and found the least informed right-wing guy you could find.
I found the director of communications of RightMarch.com, which is the group that has publicized this thing to high heaven and has led the charge. This is the number one guy.
That boy has got to go back to the mailroom because he didn't know what he was talking about. And not from a supporting your allegations viewpoint.
Yeah.
But the man who
I think he's used to going on right wing talk shows where they just pat him on the head and say thank you very much.
I've never heard of him before.
Okay.
And I could have handled all your allegations much better than he could have.
Okay, well Dave, you've got a minute and a half. Go for
it. Okay, well Bill Burkett, the man who loathes the Bush family, is the one who brought these documents forward.
Right, but where did he get them? He is not a forger.
Now, you said that you thought there was a Karl Rove operation, but to think that he would accept anything from Karl Rove is stretching credulity.
Oh, yeah, I don't for a minute think that Karl Rove called up Burkett and said, hey, I'm Karl Rove, here, have some documents.
Right.
Come on, give me a break.
The thing is, these documents were manufactured. They're
sure.
Not based in reality.
Maybe.
No evidence to support that they are real.
Actually, and there's no evidence to support that they're a forgery. The conclusion of Thornburg's group was that
shows that they're forgeries, that they're fake, they're made out of a whole cloth.
Maybe not. Maybe, maybe not. But let's say that they were. Again, where did they come from? Burkett didn't create them.
He made them.
It doesn't. No, come on. Burkett didn't have the technology. I'm sorry, Dave.
All he needs is a PC today.
No. You need a lot more than that.
Bonjour. My name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
major power blackout sheds some light on problems with air pollution. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. In August 2003, 8 states and the province of Ontario lost electricity when power plants and electrical grids shut down. Researchers at the University of Maryland saw a unique opportunity in the midst of this blackout. It was a chance to find out how much air pollution originates at power plants. Laxin Marufu is an atmospheric chemist at the University of Maryland in College Park. He and his colleagues have been flying over Maryland for more than a decade to measure air quality. Marufu says the air is polluted by a lot of different compounds that come from a variety of sources. He says it's hard to determine how much pollution comes from each individual source, but the blackout suddenly provided an opportunity to study the effect of emissions from power plants.
By turning off power plants, while all other factors were kept fairly constant, it provided a unique opportunity to quantify directly and for the very first time the contribution of power plants to regional haze and ozone.
Just 24 hours after the blackout began, Marufu and his colleagues were in the air. They flew downwind of the blackout area and took air quality measurements. They compared their results with measurements taken before the blackout in the same locations. Marufu says they got a big surprise.
What was surprising was not the fact that we saw an improvement in air quality. We expected that. But what surprised us most was the magnitude. We did not expect it to be that big.
Marufu says emissions of sulfur dioxide dropped by as much as 90% and ozone dropped by about 50%. Marufu says that rapid change is encouraging. He says it shows that effective emission controls at power plants could improve air quality along the East Coast, and they could do it quickly. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour. We don't need to wait for the music there. Here, this is where this is going. It's the next step, right? Step one, go after Dan Rather and CBS. Step two, go after anybody who reported what Dan Rather said. Now, this wasn't a story that Dan Rather broke. This story was broken in 1999 by the BBC. And they have never retracted it. In fact, they have the documentation. We're not talking about these questionable documents, shall we say, which have not been demonstrated to be forgeries yet, by the way. BBC has been saying this all along. And yesterday, Accuracy in Media is this right-wing group that tries to terrorize news outlets, issued a new news release saying that USA Today editor Ken Paulson should apologize because he said some of the same things Dan Rather said. Well, the points of the article are not in dispute. Good grief. Come on, guys. Get a life. Jeff in Charlotte, North Carolina on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind here? The last minute or so here of the show, of this hour.
Hi. Hi. Sir, I looked it up. Prior to the Roe v. Wade decision, the Democrats, out of 13 Southern states, control 22 out of 26 Senate seats. They control 65% of all the representative seats in the House of Representatives. The abortion issue is a complete disaster for the Democrats. They own 2 Senate seats in the South now.
Yeah, although really, if you look at the South, if you want to talk about what flipped the South from the Democrats to the Republicans, it was LBJ's support of civil rights and desegregation.
Well, I understand that. But
that was Nixon Southern strategy.
Any cause?
No, I think I agree with you. Abortion had something to do with it. I don't think it was the huge factor that you're saying it is. I think it was a big factor, but the big factor was desegregation.
I'm not willing to throw away all our power for one issue. I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people saying that. That's why they're saying that Tim Romer, who's an anti-abortion, put those women in jail, kill those doctors, Democrat, should be head of the DNC. And
I mean, there's ways to look at it. I look at it this way, Tom. When it comes to criminal law, the American public are going to decide what our women is arrested for.
Yeah.
I don't think it's... I think the best thing for the Democrats is to get the abortion issue out of the national debate.
I don't disagree with you, Jeff. I think that actually this needs to be dealt with legislatively rather than judicially. But that's a whole other and larger discussion because I don't want to get into at this moment. First of all, because we've wrapped up the top of the hour. But you know, thanks for the point. Well said. I suppose this is just too large an issue to take on in a minute and a half. It's the Tom Hartman Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, "To people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times." Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. Two newly elected Republican governors have wiped out collective bargaining for state employees in Missouri and in Indiana. Ken Jacob with Missouri's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees says Governor Matt Blunt's assault on collective bargaining rights should be resisted.
The right to organize and collectively bargain is a fundamental right, and it needs to be fought for like all rights.
Jacob expects Missouri to honor its contract with state workers through 2006. In Indiana, AFSCME's David Warwick says GOP Governor Mitch Daniels' order attacking collective bargaining wipes out years of labor progress under Democratic governors.
He rescinded not only our rights to bargain and our union representation rights, but also he rescinded our union contract.
State employees don't have the same national labor law protections as other workers. The defeats of Democrats and victories by Republican governors in Missouri and in Indiana have dealt state workers there devastating blows. But AFSCME says that the unions will stay in place and will do whatever they can to continue to represent state employees.
It's been a rough start to the year for Starbucks. In Florida this week, a federal court judge granted collective action status to a lawsuit filed by two managers who say they are entitled to overtime pay because they are actually glorified baristas. The status gives the attorneys filing the suit permission to find other managers throughout the country who have similar complaints. Meanwhile, in New York City, workers represented by the Industrial Workers of the World watched as the National Labor Relations Board agreed with their charges that the coffee chain has been interfering with and coercing employees who have attempted to unionize.
The Labor Board also alleges in their complaint that Starbucks made outright bribes, created an impression of surveillance, and much, much more.
Daniel Gross is an employee at the New York store. According to the board, seven Starbucks officials, including Senior Vice President Martin Anisi, engaged in union intimidation. Gross says now that the board has ruled, other Starbucks employees are being encouraged to join.
No majority of workers is required. Anyone can join at any time and get started with other Starbucks folks around the country imposing real economic, political, and social costs on this company until they do the right thing. And every single Starbucks worker rises out of poverty.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The average annual income of the richest 1% of the U.S. is well above $515,000, an increase of 89% since 1986, according to Acorn's National Living Wage Resource Center. But at the same time, a recent study of U.S. workers working more than 35 hours a week found that poverty among them has risen. Since 1994, more than 50 cities and counties in the U.S. have passed living wage ordinances in an effort to make sure full-time workers rise above poverty.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with the Cuban blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org or call 215-563-7110.
Have you got your ticket yet? You're simply nobody if you don't have a seat at the exclusive lunch being held for Bush's inauguration, where you can break bread with George himself. You might find the bread a bit pricey, though, since the ticket goes for $250,000. But that's not as bad as it sounds, for not only do you get to shoot the breeze with George, but Dick Cheney will also be there, so you get a twofer. George likes the small talk, but with Dick, you can talk some serious business, like maybe about that little regulatory change you need the Bushites to make for your company. Oh, that's another benefit you get. The $250,000 underwriter ticket comes with a promise that, quote, your corporation will be recognized on all printed materials. So your bean counters back at headquarters can just write off the quarter mill as an advertising expense, totally deductible from the corporate income tax. Don't you love the loopholes? And hey, you don't get loopholes unless you're sitting at the table with the big boys. It's called pay to play. What a great country. But wait, you say, I don't have $250,000. Not to worry. You can buy the sponsor package for only $100,000. See, there's room for everyone at Bush's table. Well, for that, you don't actually get to lunch with him, but you would get to attend one of three elegant dinners featuring appearances by George and Dick. Sure, some of you liberal-type spoil sports will say it's unseemly to be throwing a week-long $40 million inaugural extravaganza for fat cats while America has 130,000 troops stuck in Bush's bloody debacle in Iraq. But the Bushites have thought of that, too. There's to be a commander-in-chief's ball, and military personnel get a free ticket to it. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, that's mighty small comfort to the soldiers in faraway Iraq, who, I imagine, would rather have George finally provide some armor for their vehicles than a ticket to his inaugural ball.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the second hour of our Thursday program, time when we take a brief break from the hard edge of politics and get into something that may be something you weren't thinking about, something you hadn't thought about, something you didn't know you didn't know, something you didn't know you needed to know, something you didn't know you didn't know you didn't know. Could it be even everything you know is wrong with regard to this?
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Maybe. What is our footprint on the earth? What is involved in this? Jim Merkel quit his job as a military engineer and arms dealer following the Exxon Valdez disaster, and since has worked to develop tools for personal and societal sustainability and peace. He founded the Global Living Project. Project. He's the author of a book called Radical Simplicity, Small Footprints on a Finite Earth. The website is globallivingproject.org. Jim, what is radical simplicity?
Well, it's looking at the radical inequities that we currently have on planet Earth, where we're part of the richest billion on planet Earth here in North America. We use 250 times the poorest billion, 250 to 1.
Yeah.
That's quite a radical inequity. So my book, Radical Simplicity, is about simplifying our lives here in North America to put ourselves more in a global context.
You know, 250 to 1, our richest billion to the world's poorest billion is actually less of a disparity than the 540 to 1 between the payroll of the CEOs of the top 1,000 corporations in America versus the payrolls of the average employee who works for them.
Isn't that intense?
It's sort of like it's like a fractal, you know. It's like
yeah.
Macro to the micro to the macro. Anyhow, so you're pointing this out, and that much of the world is very poor. We are very rich. Do you believe that it is our richness that is keeping the rest of the world poor?
Yeah, well, just imagine we went down to the pizzeria and you have a pizza pie in front of you. And there's four of you, and one says, well, I want three times more than you other three people. So I want three quarters of the pie. So the other three there have to split up one quarter.
Right.
That's just simple math. So if we're taking 250 times, this is why you have 60% of the world's people living on $520 a year average.
Yeah, now I have
this
to say...
why you have the poorest billion a quarter a day.
Yeah, yeah, and I've written about this in a book called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and I agree with you. However, I think that there's something... I'm sure you're familiar with Julian Simon.
Yeah.
You know, Julian Simon, I once thought of him as the incarnation of evil, and then I read a couple of his books, and I he's dead now, and I still think of him as somebody who is very, very toxic for our society and a great rationalizer for consumption. But he did make one really good point that I think that we on the left, or those of us involved in the environmental movement, need to keep in mind, and that is that human intellect, that our ability to transform things, our ability to change things, is very often not part of the equation when we look at things in these very stark terms. I mean, you're talking about a pizza pie, and if we were talking about wealth, of course, you can't talk about it that way because wealth is something that varies dramatically from generation to generation, year to year. So very often then people say, well, let's talk about water. You know, there's a finite amount of fresh water in the world. You know, 1% of the world's water is fresh water. 80% of that is locked up in glaciers and the Great Lakes. But the reality is that we are developing progressively less expensive technologies to purify water. And so fresh water can become more available. So why would it have to be that we would have to give up a substantial portion? Now, you know, much of our lifestyle, I know you're living on $5,000 a year, which is a really, I mean, this is radical simplicity. Why would we have to give up that much in order that the rest of the world can rise out of starvation and whatnot? Why not be putting more effort into things like water purification technologies, micro energy technologies, micro lending, economic technologies, things like this, and working toward those rather than putting the focus on ramping down our own lifestyle?
Well, I'm a believer in the yes and principle. I think all the things you're saying is yes. We need to do all those things, and we need to be more equitable.
Yeah.
Okay, so
well said.
For instance, if we are to use technology to be more efficient, basically the tool I use in my book, Radical Simplicity, is a tool called Ecological Footprint,
right,
which your overall footprint of any item that you want in your life, whether it be electronics I want insurance, I want education, I want transportation, I want housing, all these things can be delivered more efficiently with a lower footprint. And at some point, I'm an engineer, so there's no ecological free lunch,
yeah,
basically. So what I'm doing is monitoring flows of resources through my lifestyle and looking at what does it take on Earth to supply, how much land area does it take to
give us a for example.
House.
Give us a for example.
Okay, for example, a typical house in North America, somewhere up to it's more like 700 square foot per person, might need 3 to 4 acres of earth, area, forests, and land just to build that house and make it a standing house.
In other words, you're talking about the copper that was extracted someplace to make the pipes and the water pipes and the electric wires and the oil that was extracted to make the insulation on the electric wires and the wood that was taken, obviously, to build the house with and all those other things that went into the house. It takes about 4 acres of the planet to build a 700-square-foot house. I'm surprised it's that little, frankly.
Yeah. Well, that's not heating it yet.
Ah, okay.
So that may add another 4, depending how you heat. So, as an example, we took on an experiment in British Columbia that built a house that was a much smaller footprint. So we built a straw bale house, and it was smaller by 5 times less square foot per person than the average house. It had a footprint 5 times smaller per person than standard construction. So we were in North America to build a house 25 times lower footprint per person.
Yeah, and actually a friend of ours here in Vermont built a straw bale house 2 years ago and also had a stream running down the mountainside behind him and built a pond for it to run into and then a water generator coming out of it. He's generating his own electricity. He's living in the straw bale house. He's heating with wood. And it's a beautiful house. This guy's got an incredible quality of life. He's completely off the grid. It's a startling. I mean, it's really nice. It's really nice.
People say, what are you giving up? They ask me, because I've been doing this for 16 years. I quit my job as a military engineer 16 years ago, been living on $5,000 a year. What have you given up in those years? And I say, I haven't given up anything. I've had the highest quality of life, way higher than when I was an engineering weenie.
Yeah.
Now I'm all over the planet. And I had a house, an apartment building investment. I had an antique car. I had a motorcycle. I had three vehicles.
Well, Jim, what do you have now? We're talking to Jim Merkel, by the way. His website is globalvillageproject.org. I mean, what do you have? I mean, what we all, setting aside the Thoreau, the Henry David Thoreau aspect of, the quality of life that you can sit under a tree and contemplate it and think that that's marvelous, which we all applaud. I mean, what is your life like? What do you own? What do you do?
Well, all my
how do you live on $5,000 a year?
It's quite simple, but it's first you got to get your housing costs low, and I've done it in 3 different locations. In San Luis Obispo, California, which is a fairly expensive city, I was there for 7 or 8 years doing more of an urban Thoreauvian funk experiment where I got my square footage low by renting out 3 of the 4 bedrooms in my house. That's how I did it there.
And that's how you covered the property tax?
What's that?
I mean, the property tax there would be more than $5,000 a year, wouldn't it?
No, it was not that high at the time.
I see.
But, for several hundred, $250 a month, I had, I was sharing this house with 3 other people. So,
right.
And then in British Columbia, I was part of a community who shared land.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't try to each have our own 10-acre, 20-acre part. We shared the property. And so then I got my property portion really low. Here in Vermont, I ended up into a land trust situation where we have a 99-year lease, but we don't own the land.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all sorts of creative ways of getting your land, your home cost low. So we have 500 square foot of housing here for my partner and I. It's got a... Mm-hmm. Grand piano in one room that takes up half the house. But we do live quite, simple. We have a Geo on the road. It's 1990. I was 14 years carless, but I did put a car on the road here when we moved back east. But it gets 50 miles to the gallon quite regularly, and it's a 1996 car. It's worth $2,000. So, it's got a fairly useful life, but that's not our biggest footprint item. Our biggest footprint item is heating our house with firewood.
Yeah, and using what, chainsaws and gasoline to cut the firewood?
We do it all by hand, all with handsaws.
Really?
Yeah.
Boy, you must be in good shape.
Well, it keeps you healthy. The largest healthcare cost, I think, now is obesity in North America, 60% overweight or obese. But for us, we carry our water from the creek in buckets. And we do our own firewood. We walk in. The land is not car accessible. So, it helps us with staying healthy and We don't have any health insurance. People say you need health insurance. Well, I haven't had it for 16 years.
Yeah. Now, we're talking to Jim Merkel, his website, globallivingproject.org. Jim, this raises two questions. I corresponded briefly with Helen Nearing back when she was still around and wrote about her and Scott. And the first question it raises is, how do you deal with, and in fact, very similar situation here, just maybe 4 or 5 years ago here in Vermont, where there was a couple that was living completely off the grid, and they just reached the point where they were in their 60s and they couldn't cut firewood anymore. I mean, how do you, I'm assuming that you're not, you know, that you're young enough that you can still cut firewood. How do you deal with your older age? And we only have about a minute and a half left, by the way. And how can the average person, I don't think the average person is going to make the kind of radical lifestyle changes you have made. What can the average person do to simply diminish the size of their footprint on planet Earth?
Well, for me, I use three tools: sharing, caring, and conserving. If you share your car with one other person, you've halved its footprint. If you put four people in the car, you've quartered its footprint. If the car gets double the miles per gallon, you're down to 1/8. If you use it half as much because you're conserving and now you're being wise and combining trips, you're down to 1/16. You can get the same with your house. You can get it very low by sharing it, by making it last longer, caring for it, and conserving, insulating it better.
Yeah.
These
closing
are simple, practical things.
Yeah, very straightforward.
That anyone can do no matter where they are, but it is radical to get your car. You can get your car used to 1/16, 1/32nd, without ecological heroics.
Yeah, we did a lot of that simply by moving into Montpelier and having we don't drive unless it's more than 5 miles away. We walk.
That's great.
Just as a starting point. We've been talking with Jim Merkel. He's the author of Radical Simplicity, Small Footprints on a Finite Earth. His website, www.globallivingproject.org. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
I appreciate it. Keep up the good work. Keep cutting that firewood. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
This is Vivilnik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartmann Show, absolutely, without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
This job is so much more than a half-hour newscast.
Brian Williams on the NBC Nightly News.
These are very serious times. This is about our world, our children. This is about as high as the stakes get.
Ongoing engagements, firefighting.
Is my world safe? Is my nation safe? Is my family safe? That's our job. That's our duty. That's all that counts.
Reporting America's story. NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams.
My job is to tell the story of our lives.
Hi, this is Tom Hartmann. If you'd like to help bring the Tom Hartmann program to a radio station in your area, please let us know. We have tools to help you make that happen. For more information, go to www.tomhartmann.com and click on the Bring Tom Show to Your Town link on the left side of the page. Thanks for your help in bringing uncommon sense from the radical middle to your community.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
I don't want millions, mister.
And welcome back.
I don't want your diamond ring.
It's Tom Rush.
All I want is the right to live, mister. Won't you give me back my job again?
Tom Rush, an old friend. And one of the most brilliant musicians in the United States. This guy is absolutely incredible. If you've never heard Tom Rush's music, go out and buy one of his CDs right now. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com. Our website, drop into our live chat room for the finest, most intelligent, most thoughtful, insightful, fascinating, interesting, and sometimes even sexy conversation on the entire internet. And it's now time for our report from Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen, in Washington, D.C., how are you?
Well, hi, how are you? It's interesting, Tom Rush, you know, my friend Kate Taylor is going to be performing with Tom in Cambridge in mid-February, actually.
Oh, really? Really?
The 19th.
25 years ago, Louise and I, 27 years ago now, Louise and I started a community for abused kids in New Hampshire, and Tom used to do benefits for us, and that's how I got to know him. And he lived in New Hampshire at the same time, and he's now out in Colorado now. But what a decent guy. What an incredibly decent guy. So,
yeah,
anyway.
I don't disagree. I actually went to a concert of his about a year ago.
Yeah, he's great.
He's still got it, as
yeah.
they say.
Yeah, he does. He does. So what's happening
okay.
in Washington?
Well, I think the two interesting stories today. One is that apparently the Bush administration is working on their international PR. They're concerned, apparently, that the good old USA is portraying the election, thank you very much, election in Iraq as the be-all and end-all of absolutely everything, and they want to lower expectations for that election.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting that they know, and also, of course, Colin Powell let it slip out, that they're going to start reducing troops in Iraq as soon as they're able to get the locals to take over. So
yeah.
most of us who have this jaundiced eye are saying, look, they are moving everything in the direction of using the elections as a reason to get out.
Right, declare victory and leave.
The other thing is that I know from a very good source of mine that essentially Colin Powell said, hey, folks, I'm willing to stay, but it's me or Rumsfeld.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. And Rummy, of course, won. He's the guy. He's the power player. He's yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Now, I'm wondering to what extent the some time ago, a couple of weeks ago, I believe it was, there was an AP story that just kind of floated through. It's one of those things that you don't, you know, it's like
right.
a little tiny story that said that George W. Bush had informed his cabinet that he did not want anybody in the cabinet meetings to be discussing or sharing with him bad news out of Iraq. He only wanted to hear good news.
Now, let me
do it with the second half of this. Number one. And then he holds a press conference where he says, you know, only four of the of the states or the precincts or whatever they call them, districts of Iraq, we can't hold elections in. Well, it turns out those four states constitute more than 50% of the geography and the
That's
population
correct.
Of the country. But he didn't appear to know that when he said that, or he was lying to us. I mean, what's going on here?
Well, that has been the whether he knew it or not, who knows? But that certainly has been what Scott has said in the briefings. It has been the continual, it's like a phrase that was clearly written down by the communications department at the White House. So that has been what everybody there has been talking about.
Huh. Yeah, only four, even though it's half the country.
Well, they have been using that continually. That is on their talking point.
It would be like saying in America, we're going to hold an election except for in California,
New York,
right, and Florida and Ohio. We're going to exclude them, but other than those four, we're going to hold an election, right?
That's exactly right. But that is a line I believe. I mean, I can usually tell by what different agencies saying, if they all say the same thing, if that happened on their morning conference call. And my guess is that is the line that they crafted for him, and that's what they're working on.
Amazing. The PR for the week.
The other interesting thing is the New York Times story this morning. There was a report that said that the congressional leaders absolutely dumped legislation that the Senate had passed on interrogation techniques. The White House said, well, they sent out a memo of that in October. Reporters knew about it. There's nothing new about this. But, of course, there is.
Interesting. Okay, we'll follow that. We'll follow up on that with you tomorrow. Ellen Ratner, thanks so much for the report.
You're welcome.
Daily report from the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. 29 minutes past the hour.
What do you get when you cross a ballerina with an insomniac? Someone who'll dance the night away.
And that's what they're doing at a dance-a-thon put together by dancers and their community coalition to raise money for kids' after-school programs. And what do you get when people bring their groups together? Healthier, drug-free communities, especially for kids. So if you're involved with a group, contact your community coalition at helpyourcommunity.org or 877-KIDS-313. Because you get more when you get together. Brought to you by the Office of National Drug Control Policy and the Ad Council.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. Two newly elected Republican governors have wiped out collective bargaining for state employees in Missouri and in Indiana. Ken Jacob with Missouri's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees says Governor Matt Blunt's assault on collective bargaining rights should be resisted.
The right to organize and collectively bargain is a fundamental right, and it needs to be fought for like all rights.
Jacob expects Missouri to honor its contract with state workers through 2006. In Indiana, AFSCME's David Warwick says GOP Governor Mitch Daniels' order attacking collective bargaining wipes out years of labor progress under Democratic governors.
He rescinded not only our rights to bargain and our union representation rights, but also he rescinded our union contract.
State employees don't have the same national labor law protections as other workers. The defeats of Democrats and victories by Republican governors in Missouri and in Indiana have dealt state workers there devastating blows. But AFSCME says that the unions will stay in place and will do whatever they can to continue to represent state employees.
It's been a rough start to the year for Starbucks. In Florida this week, a federal court judge granted collective action status to a lawsuit filed by two managers who say they are entitled to overtime pay because they are actually glorified baristas. The status gives the attorneys filing the suit permission to find other managers throughout the country who have similar complaints. Meanwhile, in New York City, workers represented by the Industrial Workers of the World watched as the National Labor Relations Board agreed with their charges that the coffee chain has been interfering with and coercing employees who have attempted to unionize.
The board also alleges in their complaint that Starbucks made outright bribes, created an impression of surveillance, and much, much more.
Daniel Gross is an employee at the New York store. According to the board, seven Starbucks officials, including Senior Vice President Martin Anisi, engaged in union intimidation. Gross says now that the board has ruled, other Starbucks employees are being encouraged to join.
No majority of workers is required. Anyone can join at any time and get started with other Starbucks folks around the country imposing real economic, political, and social costs on this company until they do the right thing and every single Starbucks worker rises out of poverty.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The average annual income of the richest 1% in the U.S. is well above $515,000, an increase of 89% since 1986, according to Acorn's National Living Wage Resource Center. But at the same time, a recent study of U.S. workers working more than 35 hours a week found that poverty among them has risen. Since 1994, more than 50 cities and counties in the U.S. have passed living wage ordinances in an effort to make sure full-time workers rise above poverty.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back.
Light of fancy on a windswept field. Standing alone, my senses reel.
Yes. It's funny. Every now and then they're interesting. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Time for a Bush Greenwatch alert. Yes, indeed, folks. Is the EPA used to do pretty good work, eh? Well, things are changing there. Now that they've brought all the corporate power to bear on it, the release yesterday, this is from the BushGreenwatch.org, folks. The release yesterday of an EPA draft risk assessment on PFOA. PFOA is a chemical that's contained in Teflon. Has been sharply criticized by a leading environmental group which charges the agency has ignored its own science panel's guidelines and industry research. Ken Cook, president of EWG, that's the Environmental Working Group, says there's a big difference between sound science and tilted science, and at every turn in this important process, EPA officials favor DuPont. Gee, what a surprise. What an absolute shocking thing. He goes on to say, we don't know if DuPont lobbyists played a role or if those were just agency mistakes. But for those who are expecting a thorough and fair review, this is a huge disappointment. No, this is the Bush administration. Come on, guys. If it helps human beings, forget it. If it helps a multinational corporation increase its profits, it's going to happen. EWG noted that 24 hours prior to EPA's risk assessment release, a study by DuPont was released showing no effects associated with Teflon. EWG added that DuPont also ignored several studies showing a rise in heart attack and stroke risk, plus its own guidelines for defining cancer potential, which normally require a chemical be considered carcinogenic when only one of five criteria is met. Teflon meets three of those five criteria, according to the Environmental Working Group. This is pretty shocking stuff. I got to tell you, it's been at least 25, 30 years that we have been using nothing but stainless steel or cast iron around here. It's no aluminum either. Anyhow, in past studies of Teflon conducted by both DuPont, Teflon's maker, and by 3M, scientists have uncovered links to cancer, evidence of immune system suppression, and risk of heart attack and stroke. They go on to say after a year-long investigation by EPA hearings last month over allegations that DuPont was suppressing the health effects of Teflon, Teflon is present in the bloodstream of 95% of Americans. The EPA is trying to figure out how this could happen. I wonder if Teflon cookware is used in most restaurants. That might account for a lot of it. Anyhow, compared to where the agency started on this subject, Cook says, it's hard to see how EPA's new direction will lead to any protection of the public from this chemical. Yes, indeed. It is hard to see. Along those same lines, now the Bush administration, George W. Bush, has decided that a renewable form of energy, you know what renewable means, don't you? It means, you know, kind of like brief, like the sun, right? Every morning it comes up again, over and over and over again. You don't have, it's renewable. It's not like, you know, your gas tank. Your gas tank is refillable. There's a difference between refillable and renewable. Well, this is from today's Wall Street Journal, an article by John J. Fialka. President Bush says the nation needs advanced nuclear power plants, calling them a clean, quote, renewable, end quote. Yes, those quotes are in the Wall Street Journal article. Renewable energy source for the future. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal on Monday, Mr. Bush said he looks forward to working with Congress on an energy bill that includes incentives for the nuclear power industry. Yes, let's give some more taxpayer dollars to the nuclear power industry. What a great idea. We have now demonstrated, we now know that the technology has matured to the point where solar cells on the roofs of houses could power virtually every home in America south of the Mason-Dixon line, and wind and water, well, just wind alone for that matter, could power every home north of the Mason-Dixon line. It's already there. I mean, and at a price comparable to what we're paying right now for electricity. We're not talking about, gee, it's going to be too expensive. I mean, the technology is here now, my friends. It's here now. Well, John W. Rowe, the chairman and chief executive of Exelon Corporation of Chicago, which operates the nation's largest group of nuclear power plants, said in a classic bit of understatement, "It's always gratifying to have the president on your side." Yes, we human beings would like the same. Ain't gonna happen, no. Not if the past is any predictor of the future. Mr. Rowe went on to say that the chairman of the Exelon Corp, the largest runner of nuclear power plants in the country. He says, the industry needs Congress and the White House to help. Why? Why can't you do it? Just pull yourself up by your own damn bootstraps, Mr. Rowe. No. In fact, probably the biggest chunk of corporate welfare on the planet is the fact that no insurance company on Earth will insure nuclear power plants. And so you and I do. Yes, you and I do. You and I pay for the disaster insurance on nuclear power plants. The federal government has picked up the tab. Why? Because insurance companies won't go near it. Environmental groups, again, back to the Wall Street Journal article, environmental groups were quick to challenge the president's use of the word renewable, which they have reserved for wind and solar energy projects. Carl Pope, president of the Sierra Club, says, most people's idea of renewable energy is not anything that produces toxic waste that you have to keep isolated for hundreds of thousands of years. It's absolutely flabbergasting that they would try to revive this technology. Well, on the other hand, Lee Fuller, vice president of the Independent Petroleum Association of America, says he wants his industry is going to seek tax incentives. Another industry that wants welfare. Where is the outrage about these welfare queens, these welfare kings? Mr. Rowe and Mr. Fuller and their showing up in their limousines and asking for their welfare checks. He says, producers, this is from the Wall Street Journal. This is not a quote from him. This is from the article in the Wall Street Journal by John Fialka. It's, in fact, it's the last paragraph, last sentence. Producers also want the government to open more federal land for exploration and royalty incentives to find gas and oil in deep water and other difficult places to drill. Yes, let's take more of our federal land, which we own collectively, and give it to the oil and gas companies, and not only not charge them for the oil they pump out of it, which belongs to us, which they're then going to sell to us, not charge them for it, but let's give them some taxpayer dollars to help them get it. Do I sound outraged? Speaking of Teflon and cancer, by the way, to go back to that one before, this version of it published in the Atlanta Constitution Journal, but it came out of Health Day News. For years, scientists have thought that olive oil might help prevent breast cancer. Now they've discovered why. This is kind of the flip side of the bad news, right? The bad news about Teflon and nuclear power. Here's the good news. In laboratory experiments, oleic acid, O-L-E-I-C acid, oleic acid, the main
Monounsaturated fatty acid in olive oil suppressed one of the most important genes involved in breast cancer. This is published in the January 10th issue of the Annals of Oncology. Epidemiological studies have reported lower rates of breast cancer in people from the Mediterranean region where a lot of olive oil is produced and consumed. This has led to speculation that a diet including olive oil may be responsible. I got to tell you, I am so fortunate to be married to a woman who is a good friend, a brilliant business partner, and also a great cook. I can cook pretty good myself. But Louise has refused to have anything other than olive oil in this house for 20 years or more. Last night, I made myself some, this is something I like, she's not real excited about this, but I made myself some popcorn. And instead of putting butter on it, which I don't think is good for me, I may be wrong, but I don't think it's good for me. What I do is I take olive oil and mix it with Parmesan, a little grated Parmesan cheese to give it a kind of salty flavor. And pour that over popcorn. Now, you may think that sounds weird. That's what I had last night as my snack around 7, 8 o'clock at night. A great big bowl of popcorn with olive oil, virgin cold-pressed olive oil, and grated Parmesan cheese. And boy, was it good. I am salivating just now thinking of it. And now we find out this prevents cancer. It's not bad. Okay, so a lot of this then gets us back to the question of why is it that we still have, you know, if Teflon might cause cancer, why is it still around? Why is it the nuclear power plants are getting subsidies? Why is it the oil and gas industry is asking for more of our tax dollars? What's going on here? The National Association of Manufacturers, which includes General Motors, Boeing, and Caterpillar, they have about 10,000 members. Now, most of these are small manufacturing companies. It's sort of like the NRA, the National Rifle Association. It's really the lobbying industry, the lobbying front group for a small number of very large corporations that make weapons. But they get all these hunters involved and make it seem like it's like some sort of grassroots thing and manipulate them brilliantly. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And you find this the same thing with the Chambers of Commerce. I'm a member of the Chamber of Commerce here. It's how I get my health insurance. And because we're a small business, right? And the Chamber of Commerce, they dance to the tune of big multinational corporations, even though virtually all of the members, at least here in Vermont, are small companies. Well, National Association of Manufacturers, no different. Dominated by large corporations who pay for most of their operating expenses, even though most of their members are small and medium-sized companies. Well, they've got a new campaign. And I guarantee you this is not something that the small and medium-sized companies came up with because they're going to end up getting screwed by it. John Engler, the former Republican governor of Michigan and good buddy of George W. Bush, is heading this thing up. It's called the American Justice Partnership. Doesn't that sound great? The American Justice Partnership. It's going to be devoted to politics, not policy. The NAM also, by the way, funds the Business Industry Political Action Committee as a slightly another thing. But here, Engler and MAM members, well, here's what Engler says. There's been too much of a tendency in the past to cast these judgeship battles. Now, wait a minute, judgeship battles? Why is the National Association of Manufacturers spinning off a political arm headed up by John Engler, this notorious Republican, to get into judgeship battles? Well, here's the bottom line. They want judges who are going to protect corporations and screw you and me. It's the average person, forget it, unless they're rich. You know, the tort reform thing, if pain and suffering capped at $250,000. If your child is permanently disabled by an incompetent doctor, a drug addicted doctor, an alcoholic doctor, somebody who a company that sells a product that they know is going to kill people, you can get a maximum of $250,000. That might keep that kid alive for 2 or 3 years if they require round the clock nursing care, maybe 1 or 2 years. But what the tort reform people don't tell you, every now and then you'll see some little mention of this in the newspaper. The big story about it actually was in the Wall Street Journal. Why? Because they wanted to reassure the rich people who read the Wall Street Journal. I shared this with you several months ago when they reported on this in the front page of the Wall Street Journal, as I recall. The tort reform is going to leave intact the ability to recover lost earnings. Okay, so they pain and suffering, $250,000 cap, but lost earnings, no cap. In other words, if you are injured and you are a multimillionaire, you can sue for multi-millions of dollars. But if you're an average guy and you're making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, you can sue for a couple $100,000 for lost wages. That's it. So the incompetent doctor says, is this person rich? If so, I won't operate on him. I'll refer him to somebody who's competent. Is this person poor? No problem. My expenses are capped at $250,000 if I get sued, you know, and I may have to pay a couple $100,000 for, you know. So anyhow, this and here's Engler talking about this. He just lays it right out. He says there's been too much of a tendency in the past to cast these judgeship battles as a social debate about abortion or gay rights. In fact, there are very few of those cases in contrast to those dealing with the tort system and the rights of individuals and companies. A tort, of course, being essentially a crime against a person or property. A harm. Engler sits on the board of the Committee for Justice, an organization that also supports conservative judicial nominees. Increasingly, the word conservative means, it doesn't mean what it used to mean. It doesn't mean, you know, conserve. It doesn't mean slow social evolution. It doesn't mean no foreign entanglements, the things that it used to mean. No, now the word conservative means in the pockets of and in bed with big multinational corporations that don't give a damn about America or about the average working person. They just want to move as much of their labor force offshore as they can so they can increase their profits so that the CEOs and the senior executives can live in their enclave, multi-million-dollar mansions, and send their kids to private schools, and we can have two Americas, to quote John Edwards. This group is headed up, Committee for Justice, headed up by C. Boyden Gray, who served as the lawyer to the first President Bush. Yeah, the Bush Empire is back. It's back. Does this surprise you? Does it outrage you? I got to tell you, number one, I am not surprised. Number two, I am outraged. It's time for us to just do an absolute house cleaning. We've got to start saying, number one, to the Democrats, get a spine! And to the Republicans, get out! 10 minutes before the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews. What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
Bonjour, my name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly, so I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique! And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir!
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555. And mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's The Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
A major power blackout sheds some light on problems with air pollution. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. In August 2003, 8 states and the province of Ontario lost electricity when power plants and electrical grids shut down. Researchers at the University of Maryland saw a unique opportunity in the midst of this blackout. It was a chance to find out how much air pollution originates at power plants. Laxin Marufu is an atmospheric chemist at the University of Maryland in College Park. He and his colleagues have been flying over Maryland for more than a decade to measure air quality. Marufu says the air is polluted by a lot of different compounds that come from a variety of sources. He says it's hard to determine how much pollution comes from each individual source, but the blackout suddenly provided an opportunity to study the effect of emissions from power plants.
By turning off power plants, while all other factors were kept fairly constant, it provided a unique opportunity to quantify directly and for the very first time the contribution of power plants to regional haze and ozone.
Just 24 hours after the blackout began, Marufu and his colleagues were in the air. They flew downwind of the blackout area and took air quality measurements. They compared their results with measurements taken before the blackout in the same locations. Marufu says they got a big surprise.
What was surprising was not the fact that we saw an improvement in air quality. We expected that. But what surprised us most was the magnitude. We did not expect it to be that big.
Marufu says emissions of sulfur dioxide dropped by as much as 90% and ozone dropped by about 50%. Marufu says that rapid change is encouraging. He says it shows that effective emission controls at power plants could improve air quality along the East Coast, and they could do it quickly. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Rainy day people always seem to know when it's time to call.
Well, in California, I suppose. Here it's snowy. Yesterday was the snowy day. Today is just a gray day. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone high up in the Green Mountains of the People's Republic of Vermont. Our quotes for the day, we have a couple today. The first from the Interior Department Assistant Secretary Craig Manson, the man appointed by George W. Bush to oversee the Endangered Species Act. Okay, the guy in charge of the Endangered Species Act, this is a quote, the Los Angeles Times, November 12, 2003, quote, "If we are saying that the loss of species in and of itself is inherently bad, I don't think we know enough about how the world works to say that," end of quote. Our second quote for the day from George W. Bush 2 years ago in Trenton, New Jersey. "We need an energy bill that encourages consumption." Yes. And also from President Bush, our quote for the day. Today is not a day for inspiring quotes, I guess. It's natural gas. This is from a speech he gave in Austin, Texas on December 20th. "Natural gas is hemispheric. I like to call it hemispheric in nature because it's a product that we can find in our neighborhoods." I think this must have been before, this was in 2000, before he had traveled outside the United States. Who knows? Actually, why am I making excuses for George W. Bush's incoherency? Clarence Thomas, just to add to the general the corrupt nature of this whole thing of, you know, high-dollar lobbying in the executive and legislative branches spreading to the judicial branch. Now, keep in mind, this Committee for Justice I was just telling you about, the whole point of this thing from the National Association of Manufacturers is to lobby judges. Clarence Thomas just accepted $42,200 in gifts over the last 6 years, far outstripping his nearest colleague, Sandra Day O'Connor, who accepted $5,000. And guess who took nothing? Justices Anthony Kennedy, David Souter, John Paul Stevens, and Stephen Breyer. No gifts whatsoever. Thomas earns $200,000 a year, and he's got to take $40,000 in gifts. His most generous benefactor is Harlan Crow, a Texas real estate executive, Republican donor. He's on the board of the Center for Community Interest, a conservative advocacy group that has filed briefs with the Supreme Court. Thomas does not recuse himself, by the way, when those briefs come forward. This is just, it's just mind-boggling. Just mind-boggling. On and on it goes. Is there no end to it? And there will be no investigation of it as long as as long as the Republicans control the House and the Senate. We have to work for the 2006 elections to take back control of the House. It's vital. It's the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's
888-242. Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. Two newly elected Republican governors have wiped out collective bargaining for state employees in Missouri and in Indiana. Ken Jacob with Missouri's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees says Governor Matt Blunt's assault on collective bargaining rights should be resisted.
The right to organize and collectively bargain is a fundamental right, and it needs to be fought for like all rights.
Jacob expects Missouri to honor its contract with state workers through 2006. In Indiana, AFSCME's David Warwick says GOP Governor Mitch Daniels' order attacking collective bargaining wipes out years of labor progress under Democratic governors.
He rescinded not only our rights to bargain and our union representation rights, but also he rescinded our union contract.
State employees don't have the same national labor law protections as other workers. The defeats of Democrats and victories by Republican governors in Missouri and in Indiana have dealt state workers their devastating blows. But AFSCME says that the unions will stay in place and will do whatever they can to continue to represent state employees.
It's been a rough start to the year for Starbucks. In Florida this week, a federal court judge granted collective action status to a lawsuit filed by two managers who say they are entitled to overtime pay because they are actually glorified baristas. The status gives the attorneys filing the suit permission to find other managers throughout the country who have similar complaints. Meanwhile, in New York City, workers represented by the Industrial Workers of the World watched as the National Labor Relations Board agreed with their charges that the coffee chain has been interfering with and coercing employees who have attempted to unionize.
The Labor Board also alleges in their complaint that Starbucks made outright bribes, created an impression of surveillance,
and much, much more.
Daniel Gross is an employee at the New York store. According to the board, seven Starbucks officials, including Senior Vice President Martin Anisi, engaged in union intimidation. Gross says now that the board has ruled, other Starbucks employees are being encouraged to join.
No majority of workers is required. Anyone can join at any time and get started with other Starbucks folks around the country imposing real economic, political, and social costs on this company until they do the right thing. And every single Starbucks worker rises out of poverty.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The average annual income of the richest 1% in the U.S. is well above $515,000, an increase of 89% since 1986, according to Acorn's National Living Wage Resource Center. But at the same time, a recent study of U.S. workers working more than 35 hours a week found that poverty among them has risen. Since 1994, more than 50 cities and counties in the U.S. have passed living wage ordinances in an effort to make sure full-time workers rise above poverty.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with the Cuban blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org or call 215-563-7110.
Maybe you're one of the 2 million Americans who've recently had their jobs offshore into India, Pakistan, and elsewhere. Or one of the millions more expected to have your job shipped abroad in the next few years. If so, don't worry, bucko, for a new growth industry has arisen that offers exciting job opportunities for you discarded Americans. You too could become an American accent and culture trainer. It seems that while such corporations as Citibank, Dell, GE, and Microsoft are eager to abandon the U.S. and move their telephone service jobs to low-wage workers abroad, these English-speaking foreign workers are, well, foreign. So their accents and cultural references can be jarring to U.S. customers placing orders or seeking help. Thus, offshoring companies are hiring Americans to teach foreign replacement workers to sound and behave like Americans. Yes, this means you could end up teaching the Indian or Pakistani or Russian who was given your job how to sound like you. Courses in American Culture 101 include U.S. history memorization, American slang, basic sports knowledge, and pop culture. Quick, what's the Lone Star State? Who are the Florida Marlins? Can you name one talent that Britney Spears has? What's a burrito? The lesson plans for these courses include having to watch episodes of Friends and screening such films as Bruce Almighty. As for accents, there are voice exercises for Indians, for example, to help them lower their natural high-pitched and clipped pronunciation of English. And if the exercises are not enough, the corporate call centers use technology to filter the telephone voices of the foreign service reps, making them sound lower than they are. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, it won't be long before the corporations train low-paid foreigners to teach American accents and culture to foreign workers. Then there'll be no need for American workers at all.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
The man who uncovered
uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
If you're not outraged, writes Matt, quoting a bumper sticker, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. Yeah, I think so. Time to pay attention. See, the unconscious mind didn't catch the knot, right? Folks in the chat room got that. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you'd like to call in, weigh in on the issues of the day. Our chat room can be accessed by going to TomHartman.com and clicking on live chat. And it'll take you over to our message board where you click on the chat link and, you know, boom, you'll be in there. And, of course, on the message board, you can leave messages. Always a fine thing to do, if you wish. Those are a little more permanent in nature. Some of them go back a year or so. There's some 40,000 messages sitting there now, I think. Thousands of members participating on a daily basis, regularly. The Bush administration is preparing a budget request. Get this. This is, as I, you know, I started to get into this yesterday. I mentioned this whole idea of starve the beast. If you cut off the funding to government, then government has to shrivel up and go away. And Ronald Reagan began this process by trying to indoctrinate people to the idea that government is the problem, not the solution. Now, the question was never raised, the solution to what? Or the problem of what? Just simply, government is the problem, not the solution. And it's become a mantra for really an entire generation. I'd say, you know, probably most people under 30 have mostly, they've spent most of their lives being exposed to con media, and they don't remember America before the conservatives took over. They don't remember when America had really and truly fair and balanced news reporting that was, there was a firewall between the news departments and the advertising and sales departments. They don't remember prior to 1987 the Fairness Doctrine. They just, you know, it's just not in their memories, in their lexicon. So Bush, Reagan started the Star of the Beast thing. He didn't have the whatever to follow through on it, which disappointed many cons, because they essentially, down in their hearts of hearts, to the extent that there is one there, to use the Grinch metaphor, believe that government is a bad thing. Anything government does is socialism, is what they call it, even though, you know, socialism, yeah, I know there's many definitions for socialism. The classic one, Karl Marx, the government owns the means of production and supply. Nobody is suggesting that. But these guys have consistently been of the opinion that we need to do away with Social Security. We need to do away with Medicare. We need to do away with public funding of our school systems. They succeeded in the 70s and 80s in doing away with much of the funding for public colleges. I remember when I was a kid, the last to go was California. And several of my friends went out to California. This was in the late 60s. If you lived there for 6 months, you could get residence status, and you could attend the University of California for free if you were a resident of the state. Now, this was an idea that was first put forth by Thomas Jefferson when he founded the University of Virginia, which you could attend for free, assuming that you could pass a basic entrance exam indicating that you were, you know, sufficiently competent to attend college. And the whole idea in Jefferson's mind was that the only way to have an active and vibrant democracy was to have an educated populace, and that one of the most dangerous things to democracy was a rigidification, was rigidity within the economic and social structure. If the wealthy always stayed wealthy and the poor always stayed poor and there was no middle class, you had, in Jefferson's mind, you had a formula for, well, by definition, I suppose you would call that a plutocracy. You had a formula for tyranny.
You had a formula for an anti-democratic or a non-democratic form of governance. Whereas, on the other hand, if you had a lot of social mobility, if it was relatively easy for people to move from being poor into being middle class anyway, and from the middle class into being wealthy, and for the wealthy, for that matter, to blow it and become poor, if socioeconomic mobility was high, then you had a society where the individual potential of individuals was far more likely to be expressed. In other words, people would rise to the top, not because their fathers happened to be former presidents or their grandfathers were rich financiers of Adolf Hitler, for example. Not because they were born into wealth, but because they themselves worked hard and accomplished something. I mean, this was the beginning of the American dream. And the idea was, hey, there's a lot of people who don't happen to be born into wealthy families, the majority of people in America. A quarter of our workforce right now works for less than $8 an hour. $8 an hour or less. A quarter. And we're talking, I'm not talking just about, kids who are living with their families trying to, if you get a little spending money. I'm talking about people who are trying to raise two or three kids and pay house payments and buy food. And it's very difficult. So Jefferson's solution to this was that we the people should be sure that anybody can get educated all the way up to and through the level of a PhD at no cost if we have the ability. That we should pay for our fire departments. This was Ben Franklin's thing. That we should pay for our police departments. That there was a social contract among us. These were the liberal ideals upon which this nation was founded. They find their roots in the writings from 100 years before the founding of this republic, in the 1600s, of Rousseau and other Enlightenment-era thinkers. Rousseau, in his book The Social Contract, opens it, his first sentence, the first chapter. There's an introduction, but the first chapter, the first sentence. Man everywhere is born free and yet is in chains. Now, I'm sure I'm mangling that quote now. But perhaps not. Man everywhere is born free, and yet we find him in chains. Something very close to that. And this was one of the things that, Rousseau, you find him paraphrased in the Declaration of Independence, was the idea that there was a social contract, that we have, that not only do we have an obligation to each other out of a sense of this is the right thing to do, and you can find the foundation of that in religion, although Rousseau did not. But it certainly, you'll find it in the Sermon on the Mount or in Matthew 25. But and throughout the Old Testament, the Jewish notion of tikkun l'olam, the Islamic notion of charity. It's in Hinduism. It's in Buddhism. It's in all of the tribal. I don't know if you can call them religions because they're not institutionalized, but all the tribal worldviews. This idea that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And if we have among us very, very, very weak links represented by massive poverty that people are unable to climb out of because they are unable to gain access to the tools that would give them the ability to climb out of poverty, then we have a chain that's not particularly strong. We have a nation that is fragile, that is brittle, that can be broken. And so we put into place these tools that allowed people to climb out, and they were used. Condoleezza Rice using affirmative action. Colin Powell using affirmative action to overcome the institutional racism, which is still very much a part of the United States. To overcome the consequences of hundreds of years in the United States of this absolutely immoral institution. I don't have a better word for it. I'm sorry, but it's a criminal enterprise might be a better way of slavery. And now we have folks saying, well, no, you know, we shouldn't have affirmative action. We shouldn't have. But it goes beyond that. See, it goes way beyond that. We shouldn't even pay for education. Now you've got a group out there saying, you know, yeah, okay, Ronald Reagan shut down the free California colleges, universities. He put an end to that when he was governor of California. That was the last one to fall. Now let's go after the public schools all across the country. And I'm telling you, this is the conservative worldview is that there are orders and classes in society, and society is most stable when those orders and classes are maintained, when there is a minimum amount of social mobility, when the poor stay poor generation after generation, and the rich stay rich generation after generation. So there should not be inheritance taxes. And the burden of the taxes should fall on the poor, which is why if you pay Social Security tax, you only pay it on the first $87,900 you make, and after that, you don't pay anything. A multimillion Bill Gates pays no Social Security tax at all on anything after the first $87,000. And yet, he's eligible for Social Security. Or even if he wasn't, although I think he should be. But even if he wasn't, I mean, this is the social contract that Rousseau talked about. That here we're in this boat together. Thank you very much. Well, where I started with this rant is this news story from the Washington Post by Jonathan Wiseman. The Bush administration is preparing their budget. And here we see the results of the Star of the Beast strategy. Cut taxes, give the money to the rich, and then say, oh, my God, we've got a crisis. We can't afford to have these programs anymore because we have this huge debt. Bush said that his 2006 budget to be unveiled on February 7th, according to Andrew Card, will impose very, very strong discipline. That discipline will be there big time. Community development block grants funded this year at nearly $5 billion could be cut back as much as half. The Home Investment Partnership, a housing program that was sliced 4% this year, is expected to take a larger hit. The president's 2006 budget. This helps people get homes, the poor. Veterans programs are expected to be pinched. Flat funding, higher deductibles, co-payments for veterans' health care, higher co-pays, squeeze on benefit eligibility. National Science Foundation will be virtually frozen. Substantial budget increases over the past decade for the National Institutes of Health will come to an end. And at the same time that we've got, you know, bird flu threatening to wipe out, I mean, this could literally kill a quarter of Americans if it's as bad as they say. And the Bush administration, well, let's cut back on funding on science. Why? So we can have tax cuts for the rich. Mindless. 20 minutes before the hour. After the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Bonjour. My name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, and I will send you three of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECOWINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
This job is so much more than a half-hour newscast.
Brian Williams on the NBC Nightly News.
These are very serious times. This is about our world, our children. This is about as high as the stakes
ongoing
get.
Ongoing engagements, firefighting.
Is my world safe? Is my nation safe? Is my family safe? That's our job. That's our duty. That's all that counts.
Reporting America's story. NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams.
My job is to tell the story of our lives.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's
888-242-8272. Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Ah, yes.
She looked me over and I guess she thought I was all right.
Maybe reasonable.
In the sort of a limited way for an off night.
There you go.
She said, don't I know you from the cinematographer's party? I said, who am I to blow against the wind?
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A wave of business mergers anticipated. An email I got from Roy, I think it's maybe Roy in Rio Rancho, I'm not sure, or Placidus Roy, he's in the chat room right now, I'm not sure, if it is, tell me. Anyhow, for the business mergers that you can expect to see, Hale Business Systems, Mary Kay Cosmetics, Fuller Brush, and W.R. Grace Company are going to merge and become Hale Mary Fuller Grace. PolyGram Records, Warner Brothers, and Zesta Crackers will join forces and become Poly Warner Cracker. Some of these are just so corny. I can't get it. 3M will merge with Goodyear and issue forth as 3A3. These, some of them are visual. Zippo Manufacturing, Audi Motors, Dofasco, and Dakota Mining will merge to become Zip-Audi-Doo-Da. FedEx is expected to join its major competitor, UPS, and become Fed Up. Fairchild Electronics and Honeywell Computers will become Farewell Honeychild. Grey Poupon and Docker Pants are expected to become Poupon Pants. And Knott's Berry Farm and the National Organization of Women, also known as NOW, will join and become Not Now. Well, Could be. Anything is possible. You just never know. I've got to say, though, we have good news for you. National Park Service, it caught you doing something right. It's always good to catch people doing things right. Better to catch them doing things right than wrong. Actually, two of them. The first pointed out to me by Tim in our chat room. He mentioned a couple of times. You don't want to talk about this. George Soros and some other rich buddies are apparently going to be doing now what Joe Coors and Richard Mellon-Scaife and all those folks did many, many years ago, funding think tanks and efforts. And, boy, if any of you know George Soros, tell him our show could use some promotion. Let us know. Anyway, they're out there. They're going to put some money into this. That's number one. The other is the National Park Service has agreed to give thousands of anti-war demonstrators a prime spot along President Bush's inaugural parade route that will allow them to protest during the procession. And this should be interesting. The anti-war group ANSWER, A-N-S-W-E-R, periods between each letter, coalition, is planning to erect its own bleachers in the space, an open plaza on Pennsylvania Avenue, just a few blocks from the Capitol building, said Brian Becker, national coordinator for the group. The bleachers could seat up to 1,000 people. The Park Service estimates up to 10,000 could fill the space standing shoulder to shoulder. Becker says he considers the agreement a partial victory, but will be inadequate because the general public will not be able to move into other areas along the parade route as they have in the past. They're taking the public sidewalks, the sidewalks that you and I own, that we bought and paid for, that we built in the nation's capital, our nation. They're taking the public sidewalks and they're saying, you can only stand on these sidewalks if you pay for a ticket to the Bush inaugural. And by the way, the cost of that ticket is not going to the city of Washington, D.C. to pay for security. Pretty strange. Secret Service is allowing protesters to carry signs, but they are prohibiting them from being affixed to poles or sticks for security reasons. Yeah. Like, we don't want the insecurity of your being able to hold them above your head where a camera might see them. And then, of course, a group called Turn Your Back on Bush is asking thousands of activists to line the parade route, actually to go through the effort of signing up with the Republicans, getting a ticket, standing on the public walkway, and then as George Bush drives by, turning your back on him. This is great. There's going to be a die-in at Lafayette Park near the White House. This is on the 6th of January. Can't be the 6th. 6th is already passed. It's the, what's the date for this? The 20th, excuse me. The 20th. And then there's the folks who are not spend a damn dime that day, too. There's all lots of stuff scheduled.
Mom, I can't believe you asked Rick all those questions. Where do you live and who are your parents? It's so embarrassing.
Getting to know your kid's friends isn't easy. But if you don't, he's more likely to do drugs.
Geez, you have to know everything?
Actually, Sean, I do. Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for Drug-Free America.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. Two newly elected Republican governors have wiped out collective bargaining for state employees in Missouri and in Indiana. Ken Jacob with Missouri's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees says Governor Matt Blunt's assault on collective bargaining rights should be resisted.
The right to organize and collectively bargain is a fundamental right, and it needs to be fought for like all rights.
Jacob expects Missouri to honor its contract with state workers through 2006. In Indiana, AFSCME's David Warwick says GOP Governor Mitch Daniels' order attacking collective bargaining wipes out years of labor progress under Democratic governors.
He rescinded not only our rights to bargain and our union representation rights, but also he rescinded our union contract.
State employees don't have the same national labor law protections as other workers. The defeats of Democrats and victories by Republican governors in Missouri and in Indiana have dealt state workers there devastating blows. But AFSCME says that the unions will stay in place and will do whatever they can to continue to represent state employees.
It's been a rough start to the year for Starbucks. In Florida this week, a federal court judge granted collective action status to a lawsuit filed by two managers who say they are entitled to overtime pay because they are actually glorified baristas. The status gives the attorneys filing the suit permission to find other managers throughout the country who have similar complaints. Meanwhile, in New York City, workers represented by the Industrial Workers of the World watched as the National Labor Relations Board agreed with their charges that the coffee chain has been interfering with and coercing employees who have attempted to unionize.
The Labor Board also alleges in their complaint that Starbucks made outright bribes, created an impression of surveillance, and much, much more.
Daniel Gross is an employee at the New York store. According to the board, seven Starbucks officials, including Senior Vice President Martin Anisi, engaged in union intimidation. Gross says now that the board has ruled, other Starbucks employees are being encouraged to join.
No majority of workers is required. Anyone can join at any time and get started with other Starbucks folks around the country imposing real economic, political, and social costs on this company until they do the right thing. And every single Starbucks worker rises out of poverty.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The average annual income of the richest 1% of the U.S. is well above $515,000, an increase of 89% since 1986, according to Acorn's National Living Wage Resource Center. But at the same time, a recent study of U.S. workers working more than 35 hours a week found that poverty among them has risen. Since 1994, more than 50 cities and counties in the U.S. have passed living wage ordinances in an effort to make sure full-time workers rise above poverty.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.
That's when you see Dick Cheney coming out.
No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid.
No, because we know what's going on. We've figured these guys out. We've got their number, and we are going to spread the word. We are going to wake folks up and stand together. For industries itching to benefit from the administration's policies, writes the Center for American Progress, the Progress Report today, President Bush has found a perfect way for them to get their backs scratched, but they first have to pay up. Pay up. At least 88 companies and trade associations, along with 39 top executives, have donated nearly half of the money needed for the Bush Inauguration Committee to reach its $40 million goal for the lavish four-day celebration. Practically all of the substantial donors have already either benefited from Bush administration policies and or stand to receive windfall profits from the second-term policy proposals. Gee, I'm shocked, aren't you? While the committee has voluntarily capped contributions at $250,000, it has turned a blind eye but extended an open hand to overachievers who circumvent this limit, willfully allowing them to donate both through a parent company and its subsidiaries. How many corporations manage to pour money, all this money in without having their funds spoiled by these pesky campaign finance reform laws? Well, we're not really sure. The laws don't apply to inaugurations. How's that for, you know, falling into the mind-boggling category? Here's another one. The Associated Press reports that outgoing Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge twice spent the night at the home of a wealthy lobbyist whose firm was, quote, aggressively expanding its Homeland Security business, end quote. Well, on the surface, you'd say, well, you know, what's so bad about that? He's just staying at the home of a lobbyist who's trying to sell him product. Well, it continues. After the visits, the firm hired two of Ridge's aides to lobby the department, including one described as, quote, the closest governmental and political advisor to Secretary Tom Ridge for over 18 years, end quote. And some of the firm's clients eventually landed lucrative long-term contracts. Ridge and the lobbyist, David Gerard DiCarlo, an old associate, had and worked together to raise over $400,000 for the 2000 Bush-Cheney campaign. Homeland Security officials now defend Ridge, insisting the two never discussed business. No, they never discussed business. But Stephen L. Schooner, co-director of the Government Procurement Law Program at George Washington University, says the administration's message is evident. Quote, when Ridge makes clear that he is not worried about appearances, we should not be surprised when the public concludes that government cannot be trusted. Well, I would say that's a bit of an overstatement. It's not that government cannot be trusted. It's that this administration, the arguably the most corrupt criminal administration in the history of the United States, cannot be trusted. That's who cannot be trusted. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jim in Cincinnati, Ohio, on the line. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
I certainly can.
Okay. This is off the subject you're talking about, but yesterday you talked about the doomsday plan. What bill was that slipped into?
I don't recall.
Oh.
I'm sorry. I don't recall.
Because I was trying to look it up on the if I could on the internet to get the details of what's in that plan. That, you know, I hate to say this, but might actually invite, you know, like they did in Germany. Remember when Adolf Hitler, that night they burned the Reichstag down?
Yeah, February 28th, 1933, the Reichstaggebüge was burned by Marius von der Lubbe, and boom, that was the beginning of the end. Adolf Hitler declared a war on terrorism that night on radio, and that was and then, you know, within a month he had a Patriot Act law passed that suspended habeas corpus and gave him the right to sneak into people's houses, and on we go.
Geez, that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah,
But the thing is, what bothers me, if they start with these crazy plans, it maybe they themselves say, well, we wouldn't do such a thing, but what's to keep somebody else down the road from doing away with Congress?
Yeah,
and
well,
then turn around appointing themselves, and also with the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Well, it's...
By declaring martial law.
Yeah, and frankly, I haven't read that law closely enough to tell you that I have a strong opinion absolutely opposed to it. I think what they're trying to do is accommodate the possibility that that plane that was shot down in Pennsylvania, shot down, to quote Jim Donald Rumsfeld, later corrected himself, but it's still a debate about it. Anyhow, that the plane that went down in Pennsylvania was headed for the Capitol building. And if,
right.
And if it took out the majority of our representatives, this was something that was not envisioned by the founders. What do you do? And I think that on the one hand, it probably is appropriate that there be some legislation that answer the question, what do you do? On the other hand, I think the legislation should have very, very strong limits on the powers of that small number of people who end up running the government. And I didn't see that in the news reports I saw. But as I said, I haven't read the bill itself, so I'm not really competent to, at this moment, to discuss it at length. I'm sorry.
Well, if you find out, please put it on, post it somewhere on your website.
I'll do that. We'll put it over on the message board. Now, there's probably already a discussion of it going on. I haven't read it today, but yeah, we'll do.
Anyway, thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling, Jim. Good to hear from you there in Cincinnati, Ohio. 1-866-889-8894. Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma is on the line. Hey, Glenn, welcome to the show.
Tom, I've been trying to understand the election. And yesterday I was watching CNN and Lou Dobbs talking about the flow of jobs to China, and there was a Republican and a Democrat discussing this. And it made me think that people just don't really understand what the right-wing Republicans stand for. The question was, what are we going to do about this problem? And as the Republicans saw it, the problem was, we're trying to raise the minimum wage. We have all these restrictions on corporations. In other words, he wanted us to become more China-like.
That's right.
With fewer regulations, with no minimum wage.
That's right. What you are seeing right now, Glenn, with the collapse of the middle class, the Walmartization of America, is the Republican/conservative agenda, period. I mean, and they're right up front about it. They're right up front about it.
I don't think people get it, that that's what they're proposing. How could you vote for people who want to lower our standards to the standards of Chinese workers?
But those people are not going to allow gays to marry each other.
Oh, well, then that's all different.
And you know, they're not going to take away your gun.
It's such a distraction. It's just baloney.
And they're not going to let them, and they're going to put anybody who burns a flag in jail.
Well, then I guess we could all just be as poor as Chinese people then.
And, but they're going to make sure that children can say a prayer when they go to school every day.
They're going to pray for food.
There you go. There you go.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for the call, Glenn. I appreciate it. It's always good to hear your righteous indignation. I honor it and share it. And sometimes a little humorous sarcasm. Actually, it wasn't sarcasm. It was irony, wasn't it? Yeah, whatever. $581 million overhaul of the FBI computer systems hit a major snag. It may not work. Yeah, you know, these things happen. Pfizer's been told it can't run the ads that it's been running because they're misleading. Good. Not good that it happened, but I mean, you know, good that our regulatory agencies are finally, in some small measure, moving ahead. Let's look into the mailbag here. We haven't done that in a while. I got this from a con, Tom Sealer, he says his name is, S-E-I-L-E-R. He says, if I'm mispronouncing it, Tom, my apologies. Maybe it's Siler. He says, he's responding to my article about first they came for the terrorists, this piece. I've gotten more email on this thing over the last week than I think anything that I've written in a year. And he says, first, George Bush has done nothing different in setting up the camps than FDR did during World War II and for much the same reason to protect the country. He says, equally, I believe if you do some research, you will discover that during World War II, many of the same restrictions on freedom that now apply were instituted as well. The country did not fall then. It will not fall now. Sorry, Tom. Franklin Roosevelt did not put people in camps. Congress did. Article 1 of the Constitution defines the power of Congress and the limits. Article 2 of the Constitution defines the powers and limits of the executive branch, the president. Article 3 of the Constitution defines the powers and limits of the judicial branch. And it is in Article 1, the legislative branch, where it says in the Constitution that habeas corpus may be suspended when the nation has been invaded or during times of national crisis. In other words, it requires an act of Congress. Abe Lincoln went before Congress in 1863, and got an act of Congress to suspend habeas corpus. That is, habeas corpus meaning let this guy go free, right? It's Latin for produce the body. Abe Lincoln got an act of Congress passed. In 1871, President Grant got an act of Congress passed when there was an insurrection in South Carolina. And in the 1940s, Franklin Roosevelt went to Congress and got a law passed by Congress. Franklin Roosevelt didn't put the Japanese. Yes, he was all in favor of it. I blame him for that. I agree with you. You know, it was a terrible thing. But it wasn't Roosevelt who had the power to do it, and therefore it wasn't Roosevelt who did it. It was Congress. And that's the whole point. George Bush is doing this. He has set up now five concentration camps in the United States. He's requesting $29 million to build Camp 6 at Guantanamo Bay. And he has put these people there without the right of access to attorney, without the right of access to a trial, without habeas corpus, the right, the basic fundamental rights that you find in the Constitution, the Fourth through the Eighth Amendments. He has put these people there by himself. And that is not what the Constitution says. Sorry, Tom, you've got it wrong. He says, first, George Bush did nothing different in setting up camps than FDR did during World War II. Nonsense. FDR did not set up the camps. Congress did. Congress holds that sole power because Congress is the branch which is the closest to the people, the most directly elected by we the people, and therefore the branch that the founders thought the really important stuff has to rest with Congress. That's why spending, for example, can only be initiated in Congress. The president can't initiate spending. War can only be declared by Congress. The president cannot declare a war. And habeas corpus can only be suspended by Congress. The president cannot do it. Yet our president, right now, George W. Bush, has done it in violation of the law. Tom goes on to say, second, Actually, what I should do is I should read you the last part of his letter first. He says, as I see it, this is just another example of Bush hating, just a more sophisticated one. You're crying wolf without any real justification. Lots of nice quotes taken out of context, lending a portent of approaching doom. Give me a break. Democrats will say and do anything to bring this man down. Even when he's right, they won't agree. He's right when that something needs to be done to protect Social Security. What do the Democrats do? One stood on the floor of the Senate yesterday and said, I'll be dead by the time Social Security runs out, so why should I risk my future by trying to fix it? You people should be ashamed of yourselves. End quote from Tom Seiler. I'm sorry, Tom. You got it wrong. First of all, I'm not a Democrat. So it's not Democrats saying anything opposing to Bush. Number two, I don't hate Bush. No, I really don't. I'm sorry, I don't. In fact, I occasionally pray for George W. Bush. Weird as that may sound, I pray that he will be enlightened, that he will wake up. I have to say it's not one of the prayers that I'm more convinced will be answered, but nonetheless, I don't hate him. I do, however, have strong disagreement with his policies. And he's not anybody that I would want to go out to dinner with, frankly. But this is not about hating Bush. And this is not about being a Democrat. You're hallucinating, Tom. Sorry. I mean that in a good way. I mean, you're imagining things that aren't there. So back to his letter. His first was, Bush did nothing different than FDR did with the camps. Wrong. His second was, he says, Bush is an elected president with 4 years to go. At that point, the president may, at his discretion, shut down the camps and let all those people go. Bush is not going to usurp the Constitution and declare himself president for life, and you know that. I think he just did. Not president for life, but he usurped the Constitution. And so this guy's rationale, he says, that would lead to a civil war, and you know that too, and so does everybody else. So this guy is saying that if Bush usurped the Constitution, that it would lead to a civil war, and I should know that and everybody else does, and that we should just let George put anybody in jail he wants under any circumstances he wants for any reason he wants, or even without telling us the reason, and not even telling us who they are, not giving them access to an attorney. We should allow him to do that because he's been elected president for 4 years, and at the end of those 4 years, he, quote, may at his discretion shut down the camps and let all those people go, end quote. Come on. When are Americans going to wake up? I mean, what kind? This seems to be a fairly rational guy. I mean, his letter is. Actually, he doesn't seem to be a rational guy. He seems to be an educated guy. His letter is, you know, well organized. It's broken into paragraphs. There are only two major misspellings. We have dumbed down America so badly. We. Who's the we? We in the media. We on the radio. I'm sorry. On behalf of the entire radio industry, the entire talk radio industry, Tom Seiler, I apologize to you. On behalf of Limbaugh and Hannity and G. Gordon Liddy and Ollie North, And Dennis Prager and all those other bozos, and even some of the ones on the left who are not bothering to give you the whole story, I apologize. I will try to do better. 10 minutes before the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brusho, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews. What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at democraticmatch.com.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
A major power blackout sheds some light on problems with air pollution. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. In August 2003, 8 states and the province of Ontario lost electricity when power plants and electrical grids shut down. Researchers at the University of Maryland saw a unique opportunity in the midst of this blackout. It was a chance to find out how much air pollution originates at power plants. Laxan Marufu is an atmospheric chemist at the University of Maryland in College Park. He and his colleagues have been flying over Maryland for more than a decade to measure air quality. Marufu says the air is polluted by a lot of different compounds that come from a variety of sources. He says it's hard to determine how much pollution comes from each individual source, but the blackout suddenly provided an opportunity to study the effect of emissions from power plants.
By turning off power plants, while all other factors were kept fairly constant, it provided a unique opportunity to quantify directly and for the very first time the contribution of power plants to regional haze and ozone.
Just 24 hours after the blackout began, Marufu and his colleagues were in the air. They flew downwind of the blackout area and took air quality measurements. They compared their results with measurements taken before the blackout in the same locations. Marufu says they got a big surprise.
What was surprising was not the fact that we saw an improvement in air quality. We expected that. But what surprised us most was the magnitude. We did not expect it to be that big.
Marufu says emissions of sulfur dioxide dropped by as much as 90% and ozone dropped by about 50%. Marufu says that rapid change is encouraging. He says it shows that effective emission controls at power plants could improve air quality along the East Coast, and they could do it quickly. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's going to come, because Americans are waking up. And some songs are just so beautiful, you have to let the bumper music play out. I mean, that's just, this is, oh my God.
But I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long.
I got a pot of that. It's gonna. Our bumpers run a minute 15 seconds, so I can't play the whole song. I'm sorry. I would love to. Plus this is a talk show, not a music show. Anyhow, it's a. When I was in Russia, back, this must have been about 10 years ago, I was working briefly in Kaliningrad. I wrote about this in a book called The Prophet's Way. And there was a fellow there who told me a story, which I've seen in other places, by the way. This is not unique. It's probably apocryphal. It's probably actually a variation on an old Stalin joke. But in any case, it's about Nikita Khrushchev. And they were de-Stalinizing Russia. After Stalin died and Khrushchev took over, they were eliminating many of Stalin's most odious policies. And Khrushchev got up before the Politburo and gave this speech in which he was denouncing Stalin. And a few minutes into it, somebody shouted out, "Why didn't you challenge him then the way you are now?" And the room fell silent, and Khrushchev looked around the room, and he said, "Who said that?" There was silence. Then he said, "Who said that?" There was silence. And then he said, "Who said that?" And there was absolute silence. The elected politicians in the room, and every one of them was elected, afraid to even breathe. Finally, after a long and strained silence, one corner of his mouth, Khrushchev's mouth, lifts in a smile, and he says, "Now you know why I did not speak up against Stalin when I sat where you now sit." The question for our day, my friends, is who will speak up against George W. Bush and his Stalinist policies? Free speech zones, taking over the public sidewalks, putting people in prison without access to lawyers, building concentration camps. Who will speak against the man who punishes reporters and news organizations by cutting off their access, who punishes politicians by targeting them in their home districts, who punishes truth tellers by destroying their wives' careers? Who? Well, I am, and now tag, you're it. Pass it along.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug? The phone started ringing. The first person said, "Whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it." And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartman Show absolutely without question.